well and up to the challenge of presenting. We will definitely ask you some questions to ensure that we are listening attentively so that we don't miss anything moving forward. So you are warmly welcomed. To the Portfolio Committee on Transport meeting, this one. Valerie, apologies.
Chair, the one from Mr. Siklolo is still ongoing. It's not available this week due to family responsibility. It seemed like the department is having connection problems. I haven't heard from all of them. I've seen a message from the Deputy Minister's staff to say they are struggling to connect. And Mr. Sithole is going to connect in the next few minutes. Otherwise, there are no other apologies, Chair.
Thank you very much, thank you very much, Valerie. We can forge ahead. Let me welcome COSATU. They are the first presenters, as I can see. Comrade Matthew and your comrades, thank you very much. Let me allow you a space to present. You have the... you have from now up until 9:30, so that you know. Otherwise, we are with you. A very warm welcome to everybody and yourself once more. My name is Msebenzi Zwane, the chairperson of the Portfolio Committee where you are presenting. I have with me my honorable members. You'll get to know about them as we move, because they'll definitely ask you some questions. Thank you very much. Over to you. I can see on my screen your presentation is already there. Let me allow you to forge ahead.
Okay. No, thanks. Thanks very much, Comrade Chair. And I hope my Wi-Fi connection is decent, because we've got, as an honorable member from Omaha, we were saying, we've got a little bit of winter coming to Cape Town. Which is good. You know, rain is a scarce commodity these days, Comrade Chair, even in the Free State. So yes, Advocate Nella, I think, is assisting me to share our presentation. And I think just to thank members for giving us space as COSATU to raise our views on what we think is a very critical and a progressive bill, a long overdue bill, which we hope will help to address the horrific conditions on our roads. So next slide. I think if Advocate Nell or Valerie could just move to the next slide. Sure. So, Comrade Chair and members, sorry, let me also apologize. My name is Matthew Parks from COSATU. And we do have a vested interest in this issue, not only because we have members who are municipal traffic officials, et cetera, provincial traffic officials, but also workers across the country take roads, and they feel the consequence of the road carnage. So, Comrade Chair, I think what's critical for us is to look at the context of this bill. We all know that we have a horrific death rate on our roads every year. We usually lose at least 14,000 deaths every year on road carnage. This is devastating for those families. They lose loved ones, but also often it plunges those families into absolute poverty. They lose breadwinners when the parents die. They can lose their homes, their cars, etc. And of course, Comrade Chair, you would know this. Let's just go back to the next slide. This also cost the economy billions of rands in wages, lost productivity. I think the committee would know best about the conditions affecting the road accident funds, where the deficit is heading towards 300 billion rands. And I think, Comrade Chair, we also would know that in many driving testing centers, there are huge allegations of corruption, including around the issuing of professional driving permits. So in short, Comrade Chair, we support this bill. We think it's progressive, and we look forward to being passed as quickly as possible. So Chair, I think the most critical thing which attracted our interest and our support when we engaged on this bill in NEDLAC a few years ago was on the complete ban on drinking and driving. Alcohol, Comrade Chair, is responsible for at least a quarter of road accidents. Clearly, the laws are not sufficient to address what is really a cultural abuse of alcohol. Alcohol is fine, but when we overconsume it, we abuse it. When we drive and put people's lives in danger, there is clearly a problem. We think the current limitations clearly are not sufficient. there's too much confusion and ambiguity around a person's weight or body mass, the age, the type of alcohol, is it a woman or is it a man who's driving, etc., etc. We think the proposal to simply ban drinking and driving is correct, and the challenge really will be for traffic officials to enforce it without fear and favor, and of course to target the most exposed persons, be it young people, be it professional drivers, etc. Next slide. Chair, on the issue for regulations for traffic schools, this is really obvious issues. It's very obvious we need provisions to set clear criteria for the conditions for driving schools, for driving instructors, and to empower government to deregister offending schools. I think committee members would know very well the continuous allegations of corrupt driving schools, where they pay traffic of testing officials, where learners are not taught how to drive properly, and so forth. And so this really needs to be uprooted, because we all know the consequence of people who can't drive on the roads. Next slide. Chair, I think we have a pandemic of corruption in South Africa. I think we've seen in the last decade that corruption has really seeped into almost every part of the state's lives. Not just politicians, but you have testing officials, you have traffic officials, you have licensing testing officials, vehicle testing officials, etc. You have continuous reports from truck drivers having to pay bribes, from taxi drivers having to pay bribes, and so forth. We don't want to get to the situation that you find in other African countries or other countries in developing world, where bribing a traffic officer is the norm. So we have to uproot this. We think the clear prohibitions for any traffic official to having financial interest in the areas of supervision is welcome. And of course, Comrade Chair, the challenges for government to enforce it, that's the critical challenge. Chair, on the impounding of vehicles, again, this is straightforward. It's logical, it needs to be done. I think we've all seen the amount of unroadworthy vehicles driving around the country. So we do need to empower traffic officials to do that. We think that the issue of just simply issuing fines and allowing these drivers to continue on the merry way doesn't help resolve the issue. But of course, Comrade Chair, we do need to put in mechanisms to prevent abuses by some traffic officials who might want to extort bribes, etc. So there would be needed to be very tight management around it. Next slide. Chair, I think the licensing plate manufacturing, I mean, this is obviously a very sensitive security issue. So I think the issue around the regulations, the authorization, the quality, etc. is critical. It's very easy for people to manufacture license. So I think these provisions are welcome and will hopefully to help provide some security needed for all of us. Next slide. Chair, I think on the issue of weighbridges, again, it comes back to the issue of corruption often. And this really, when you have officials trying to extort bribes from truck drivers, it becomes a problem. Drivers are under huge pressures to get to the destination by the employer as quickly as possible. There's a temptation to pay the bribe. But again, the consequence to all of us is unroadworthy vehicles, overloaded vehicles. But of course, we also know the damage to our roads is huge, and they prematurely age, causing potholes, especially in some of the more rural areas or the high industrial areas as well. Next slide. So the driver license cancellation, I mean, it's a sensitive issue. It needs to be handled sensitively. I think we know that many workers depend upon having driver's licenses to get to their jobs, teachers, for example, but also many workers require driving licenses to maintain their job, truck drivers, etc., taxi drivers. So yes, the officials must be empowered to cancel licenses under certain serious conditions, but again, you need to have mechanisms in place to prevent it being abused or being used in a reckless manner, if I can put it that way. So there is a need for nuance. Around the driving testing centers, Chair, I think these provisions are logical. And again, we have continuous reports of cheating in some of the testing centers, bribes, etc. This does no one a favor. It doesn't do a favor to those persons cheating, and it doesn't do a favor to any of us. So again, these provisions are welcomed. Chair, around the professional driving permits, I think, yeah, these tightening of the requirements are long overdue. We do think you need to have a bit of an overhaul of the PDP testing requirements and so forth. Often people use the PDPs as a shortcut to get the driving license, because the conditions actually are easier at times than going through your normal driver's license. And if you think about a chair, people have got PDPs, they're entrusted with the serious responsibility of the passengers, of other road users. So it actually should be a more tight and more rigorous process. Next slide. Chair, the emergency vehicle provisions, they're quite straightforward. They're useful because they provide an indication when emergency vehicles can exceed the speed limit or how they can proceed through red lights, et cetera, the conditions and so forth. I think our point here, Comrade Chair, is that whilst the provisions are quite clear, and I think they're useful in that they provide clarity, that it speaks to fire vehicles, emergency ambulance vehicles, vehicles in pursuit of saving lives, et cetera, there is a issue we have to raise. We have members who work in the police service. Obviously, the majority of police officers belong to POP Group. That includes the VIP protection officers who protect ministers, MECs, other VIPs. And every now and then, as we all would know, someone dies. There's a minister who is late for a meeting. The VIP unit drivers drive at horrific speeds and someone dies. I think we all remember the painful incident a few years ago, the late Comrade Collins Chabane passing away, in the Northwest, the late Deputy Minister for Health, Dr. Sefolaro, and others who have passed away. We mourn the losses, it's a painful moment, but we don't fix the situation afterwards. So we think the provisions are fine. They provide clarity that doesn't include SAP VIP unit officers. We might want to tighten it and make it very specific, but I think we might also want to look at the guidelines for this VIP unit officer to make it very clear that unless the minister's life is in danger, physically in danger, they cannot exceed the traffic laws, they cannot exceed the speed limit, they cannot jump through traffic lights. Because what I think we've all seen is that often these colleagues are put under difficult conditions and they pay the price afterwards, and including the politicians also pay the price. Next slide. So I think I made this point, Comrade Chair. Next slide. Chair, just coming towards the end, around the import exemptions, and it's fine to have exemptions allowing the minister to give conditions for certain cars to be imported, but I think it's a little bit vague. It does provide clarity that the import exemption should not impinge upon road safety on the road. We think it could get a little bit more clear on that, including passenger rights. I think we've seen, for example, around some of the taxis, minibuses, which are brought in, but were actually never designed to be taxis, and they were converted to taxis and so forth. I think the Western Cape Provincial Legislature had done quite excellent research on that about a few years ago, showing the cost to lives. But also, Chair, that different countries have got different environmental standards for the cars they manufacture. This is going to become increasingly a tight issue. So we do think we need to make sure that when we provide import exemptions, that those cars being imported don't undermine our environmental laws or other environmental laws that we need to be in sync with. Especially as you find increasing amount of countries stop producing cars, et cetera, China and so forth. So this should be cleared and it should be tightened a bit. Next slide. So Chair, just coming to the conclusion, I think first, this is a straightforward bill. It's a long overdue bill. We support it. Its provisions are logical and it's progressive. We do urge Parliament to pass it as quickly as possible. We do want to raise one concern, Comrade Chair. We know there are some of our colleagues in the liquor industry who won't support the banning of drinking and driving. They will raise administrative issues, they'll raise legal issues, constitutional issues, etc. I think for us, Comrade Chairs, we have all seen during this pandemic, alcohol abuse is a serious problem. 14,000 people die on our roads every year. A quarter of them die because of alcohol abuse. It provides a huge strain on the fiscus, on the Road Accident Fund, which suffocates the economy because we're now having to have taxpayers, businesses pay a very expensive Road Accident Fund. It overwhelms the emergency units at hospitals, and they should be focusing on other issues, especially now with COVID-19. So we'd want to plead to the committee not to water down the banning of drinking and driving. Next slide. Chair, I think also for this bill to, when it's passed into law and signed by the president, it does need to include a mass public education campaign to make sure all officials are aware of the obligations and the restrictions, including the prohibitions of financial interests. the road users are also aware of the legal obligations, Comrade Chair. But I think also we think government needs to take road safety much more seriously. This bill will remain exactly that, a bill, nice English words, if we don't sufficiently capacitate traffic enforcement at a provincial level, at a municipal level, etc. The shortage of traffic officials is a key part. If you squeeze them of resources, it's been very difficult for them to enforce it. And we think, Chair, to be honest, government has been very soft on this issue and it needs to be much more firm. We shouldn't be only having arrival life and Easter and Christmas. It should actually be throughout the year. Of course, because that's the cost, Comrade Chair, is countless and unnecessary deaths and, of course, bleeding the economy of billions of rands. So I think that's it, Comrade Chair, and thanks, members, for giving us space. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Comrade Matthew Parks, for your presentation on the National Traffic Amendment Bill. I hope members have grasped what you're presenting. You were straight to the point. And as you were asking members not to water down this issue of 0% when it comes to the usage of alcohol, I did promise you that we are listening attentively and you'll measure that by members who are going to ask you some questions for you to clarify so that as we move forward, we also take your presentation into consideration. I already have two members who are capable and willing to ask you some few questions. They are now three. Let me start with Honorable Chris Onsinga, followed by Honorable McDonald, and it will be Honorable May, Honorable Manu, Honorable Stoller in that order. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you for the presentation, which we received from COSATU, also for the submissions that we received in text. Just as a general question, I'm curious about the statistics and the numbers that you use as reference, whether these are basic generated statistics or do you have a database within the organization that you relied on, which obviously could contribute in a wider spectrum. You are also speaking and referencing corrupt driving schools. Have you as an organization in any way addressed this by laying complaints? And the next question is basically tied up between your slide 5 and slide 6, where you say that anti-corruption measures and mechanisms need to be tightened up. Could you please expand on that? What are your basic ideas around this? And slide 9, I think it was the last point on slide 9 said, abusing this provision threatens many jobs. If you could expand on that, it would be useful for our insight. Thank you, Chairperson. Those are my questions for now.
I like the pin on your jacket, Honorable Member. Beautiful. Honorable McDonald.
Chairperson, thank you very much. Good morning, colleagues. Special welcome to Comrade Matthew Parks. Chairperson, I just have a few comments and a few questions. As much as I agree with about everything that that has been raised here, I'm not 100% in agreement on the alcohol situation. Chairperson, let me expand. 40% of current deaths on the road, it's around 39, 40-something percent of the roads are pedestrians. Are we going to be sitting here 2 years from now and amend the bill and stop people from walking on the road? Because pedestrians have to walk on the roads, people, because of the spatial inequalities that happened during apartheid. So a lot of people have to walk to work, because of poverty and of a lot of reasons. So I, as much as I agree that alcohol does contribute, I think a 0% alcohol is just too much, because I am reading an article, a medical article that was that during this COVID period, inadvertently, all of us have been having a 0.01% alcohol content in our blood during the times that we move a lot and use hand sanitizer, which is 70% alcohol. So, Chairperson, that would put all of us in jail, and it would not be. The problem here is law enforcement. We don't have law enforcement. If you read the whole document of COSATU, it speaks about law enforcement. More better law enforcement. The weighbridge is broken because there's no law enforcement. The unroadworthy vehicles, law enforcement. Everything is a part of law enforcement. And where there's corruption, where Comrade Parks has explained in the licensing departments, and those people must go to jail, Jefferson. And we mustn't shy away from that. Corruption is corruption, and those people need to go to jail. But Jefferson, I think those are my submissions. I thank you, Jefferson.
Thank you, Honorable McDonald, Honorable Pete May.
Thank you, Chairperson. Good morning to all colleagues. I can't support Mr. McDonald. I support driving without drinking. As COSATU said, it's long overdue. So many innocent people die on our roads. Sir, but what worries me is the position as far as the renewal of driver's license are concerned. Isn't it time that we extend the period for renewal of licenses from 5 to 10 years? And one of the reasons is the long queues, especially the elderly. That's one of the main problems. And I see it as a money-making business. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Akhbar Liede. Let us know Akhbar Liede Ketamabala Stole.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you to COSATU for their presentation, and greeting to all members of the portfolio committee and the officials. Chairperson, first of all, I want to thank the COSATU because their submission is very clear and straightforward. But there's only two issues that I need to get it from them, their understanding and how what is their proposal. The issue of poor quality licensing plates, because they say it undermines enforcement of traffic laws. If they can actually elaborate on that one. And the other one, the issue of fake and public duplicate or stolen license plates, because that one is very serious. It is happening, and it is happening very fast in this country. How, their understanding and their proposal, what are they proposing on these issues? And the last one, Chairperson, is that one under driver's license cancellations, because if you check that they say that we need to handle it with care, but if they can give us their input or their proposal, how can you handle this one? Because actually is a crisis. That's why we want to amend a lot of our rules, because there's a lot of things that is happening in our country, because corruption is more than what you think. So now if they can actually help us to understand, and I'm very supportive to what they say about 0% of alcohol, because alcohol is causing more of fatalities in this country. Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Mandisa. Master Tega Manju Chambase. Ubaba Odisa Waman.
Thank you very much, Chair. Apologies, I joined a bit late. I had connectivity issues, but I did get the whole presentation. But I thought I should apologize, Chair. Good morning to you, to the colleagues, particularly also to our guest, Comrade Parks. Well, on I want to go straight there. I will not make a view as to whether I agree or not, because I think we will listen to quite a lot of people. On your slide number 2, under social, economic, and governance context, second last bullet, you talk about traffic regime, margin, corruption. Not all, but most of the traffic officials who are mired in corruption are your members, through Popru and through Nihau. Can you tell me what are the things that you are doing other than hoping that legislation will deal with corruption, as COSATU, as these are your members? Not all, but quite a lot. Now, on the complete ban, which is slide number 3, on alcohol driving, you put percentages, and my colleague has asked you a couple of things. Bullet number 3, you talk about current limit allow too much ambiguity. Can you expand how can drawing blood and testing blood on somebody's alcohol or evidentiary breath testing, how does it cause ambiguity? If you could clarify me there, I would appreciate it. And the last bullet on the same one, slide number 3, you say it must be ruthlessly enforced, and which I think is a statement you are making. And again, my comment is, it is your members, or some of your members at least, through those two unions that I've mentioned, that are responsible. Have you established why are they not doing it now? Because they've got enough legal tools to enforce the current legislation. On slide number 4, on driving schools, second bullet, which is the middle one, you say driving schools are notoriously corrupt, fail to teach learners properly. Do you have facts? Do you have statistics? Can you give a tangible fact as to say this is the percentage of people who are tested? These are the ones who have gone through the driving schools, and we can show that the ones that went through driving schools, because you are suggesting that those that are taught by their parents or brothers or husbands or wives, they are better trained by driving. Can you give us some meat there? How do you get to that conclusion? On slide number 5, traffic officials, business interests, I don't have a comment there or a question. Impounding of vehicles, again, second last bullet there, it's slide number 6. You say, must not be abused by traffic officials to extort bribes. Once more, I sound like a stuck record. Some of these are your members. What is COSATU doing to address that rather than hope legislation will do it? Because if you amend legislation, it's still the same people who must enforce it, who you allege that are corrupt. What will change because the legislation has changed? It doesn't change the people. What will be different? If they can't enforce the current legislation, what will cause them to enforce and not extort bribes if any amendment is made? On license plate manufacturing, you mentioned in bullet number 3, fake duplicate of stolen license plate presents serious security. Again, I would like to know what has been your findings there, and what are the things that you think can stop those duplicate and fake license plates, which I agree with you 100% there. On weighbridges, I will skip that one. Driver's license cancellation. I want to suggest that even currently, licenses can be cancelled. What do you think now, if there is an amendment in any legislation, would cause the same people to enforce the current legislation? I will jump quickly to professional driver's permit, slide number 11. You make the statement there, and I want you to correct me if I'm right or wrong, that people go through the PDP, which I assume you wanted to say PRDP. But you make the statement that people go through PDP to short circuit cars. I couldn't understand that one, what you exactly mean there. How could people take that shortcut? A clarification there will assist. On the issue of emergency vehicles, slide 12, you suggest there that maybe guides through the VIP protection unit should be made when the life is in danger. Are you suggesting that that should be legislated? Or are you suggesting that SAPS, and in particular some of your members, should push within the SAPS that these guidelines be there? So do you see it as a legislative issue under the National Road Traffic Act, or do you see it as a SEPS issue, or even defense, because defense has got also those which are quite fewer than SEPS anyway? On import exemption,
as you round up, Honorable Chambers.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, all right, I will leave it there. After being intimidated, it's difficult to continue. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you very much. I like the way your dress code today. Thank you, Chambers. Honorable Boramatwa.
Ah, Dimacheron.
Abu Di.
Mzurati Duro Navashumi San. Honorable Chairperson, let me also join my colleagues who are welcoming the presenter from COSATU. But most of the things that I wanted to indicate have been said by my colleagues. But I want to, nevertheless, let me indicate that my colleagues raised an issue of corruption. Corruption is being made by employee and employers. All of them does corruption. What are the programs or campaigns that COSATU is having to their employees or workers that falls under COSATU? Because they are saying there is corruption and they don't want corruption. On the enforcement of law, most of the traffic officials, they own taxis. And so it's so difficult to enforce law because they are the owners of the taxis. So what is it that COSATU is doing concerning that? Because now, if COSATU will come here and say there is no law, there is no enforcement of law, whereas their members from Nehau and Popcrew are the owners of the taxes, what are they doing? Are they having a policy concerning that? Lastly, they spoke of 0% alcohol. Chairperson, we know that there are some foods and medicine that contain alcohol. So now if we can say 0% alcohol, I don't think it's going to be, we're going to be real. We must face reality here so that we cannot say people are having alcohol in their blood, whereas they didn't take any beer or any alcohol. I think it's something that we need to consider. Thank you very much, Chairperson, for the opportunity. I rest my case.
As you rest your case, as you lower your hand, thank you very much, Boramadwa. Our last speaker on this matter is Honorable Noluchungu Nonda.
Thank you, Chair, and good morning to the department and my colleagues. Let me first thank COSATU for the presentation. Most of my questions have been covered by the previous speakers. However, I have just three questions to ask. COSATU, you have come up with a number of recommendations, and there are just three specific questions that I would like to ask you. The first one would be, do you have any suggestions on mechanisms that could be put in place to prevent corruption? Mm-hmm. The second one would be challenges with, there are challenges with impounding in terms of storage. Any suggestions in terms of impounding unroadworthy vehicles, as you know that there is a challenge of storage? And the last one would be, what could be done to prevent fraudulent manufacturing of number plates? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Member. That was the last member who raised their hands. As I go back to Comrade Parks, I just want to indicate that we are not yet making our own views here. We are broadly allowed to ask questions to ensure that we understand where we do not understand, so that as we sit as the portfolio committee, then we are able to represent broad views of people who have presented. Comrade Parks, you want to say something? You are welcomed. A quick response will actually be welcomed.
Okay. No, thanks very much, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members. I think the questions are quite helpful. I don't think there are any perfect answers. I think these issues that we're dealing with are complex issues. They've been there for years. I think all of us, you know, every Christmas, we see the horrific road toll count. I think going back to when Mac Maharaj was Minister of Transport, Comrade Chair, many years ago, we would see the Arrive Alive campaign. So this has been a huge problem with us for many years. To Honorable Hunslinger, just about stats. Look, I'll be lying to you to tell you that COSATU can monitor these kind of stats all the time. Basically, we get our stats from those who are experts, who are well-versed in the issues, whether it's from the AA, the Department of Transport, the municipalities, the media, etc. So for example, the 14,000, those are figures that are regularly provided to us by those colleagues who are much better placed than all of us to know the conditions on the ground. And of course, there always is a danger of underreporting as well. And often we focus just on the peak seasons, like of Christmas and Easter and so on. On the issue of corrupt driving schools, I think we've all seen quite a few instances, especially when provincial departments, the police, the hawks have raided some of these schools. There have been quite a few in Limpopo and other areas. I wouldn't be able to give you a holistic thing, but the fact that the hawks and the law enforcement time and again have had to do it indicates a problem. And I think there have been quite a few media articles around it. And of course, you can go to many young people, many colleagues of ours in different trade unions would all raise issues of how they had to pay a bribe to the teacher, who then paid a bribe to the traffic department. Obviously, some municipalities are a bit worse than others, but it is a problem nonetheless. So, Comrade Chair, just to the issue of some of the issues around corruption, which I think quite a few members have raised. I think for us, Comrade Chair, the provisions here are quite useful, that it begins to try to tackle it. So the provisions are quite clear that there's going to be a prohibition of any financial interests from testing officials, from vehicle testing officials, from traffic officials, and so forth. That's what's critical, Chair. We have to build a society based upon the rule of law, where the rules are very clear. Right now, I think there's been far too much ambiguity, and hence there's been kind of this kind of laissez-faire approach. It is going to mean some people are going to be irritated, Chair. But this is an issue, for example, colleagues mentioned the issue of Nahau. Nahau members who work in provincial departments of transport have raised concerns that they have to approve taxi permits. And if they don't do it, the taxi driver or the owner will tell them, look, I'm a police officer. You must watch out. So we have to provide very clear, tight rules. that are unambiguous to all of us. I think of the issue of corruption, quite a few members have raised, be it Honorable Mangu, Noluchungu, and a few others. It's a difficult issue. I must say, Comrade Chair, that COSATU is not a government, it's a trade union. So we represent the interests of workers on the ground. We try to articulate it, but the point is well received from Honorable members. That what is the solution to dealing with the issue of corruption? And obviously, yes, our members must play a role around exposing it, whether they work in the police, the municipal traffic departments, government, etc. Many of them have played a significant role. I think comrades would, honorable members would rather know that some of our members have actually died as a consequence. There was a case a few years ago where some of our municipal shop stewards in Vembe district were murdered during the VBS scandal for exposing corruption. I think first, Chair, a couple of things to tackling corruption. One is to have very clear, unambiguous laws. Yes, we must all play a role in enforcing it and blowing the whistle and reporting it, etc. But there is also a role for the leadership of the NPA and SAPS, which often, to be honest with you, they've not played that role. We think that actually you need to have a firmer hand from the president, the minister, the MEC downwards, that yes, they can't interfere in cases. They mustn't interfere in cases. You know, cases must be not politically biased, etc. But if the leadership of the NPA can't process cases, they need to be held accountable. If they can't do it, they must be asked to resign. You can't have a situation, Comrade Chair and honorable members, where people are charged for corruption, but then it takes years for their trial to actually happen. That is not sustainable. They need to be moved with much greater speed. There needs to be a prioritization of commercial crimes courts. They need to be sufficiently resourced to deal with issues and to avoid this endless delay that we are seeing all the time. Chair, I think other issues is about holding management accountable. It's about conducting lifestyle audits, especially for a role for SARS to play in that regard. Chair, I think the other issue is that you have a very powerful act that was passed by Parliament about 2 years ago, the Auditing Amendment Act, which empowers government to confiscate the assets of any official who is found guilty, implicated, et cetera, in corruption, wasteful expenditure, and so on. And very few persons have actually felt the brunt of that law. You would have to ask yourself, what is the role of the asset forfeiture unit, and are they really playing the role they need to be playing? Chair, I just want to go through some of the issues quickly. So I think the issue of impounding vehicles, cancelling driver's licenses, et cetera, the provisions are correct. The logic is correct. You can't allow unroadworthy vehicles or persons who cannot physically drive safely, et cetera. But the point is there must be mechanisms at a management level to make sure it's not abused. Officials who issue those things must provide explanations, must be clear accountability, checks and balances, and of course, reasonable appeal mechanisms. Because you are dealing with people's lives, you are dealing with workers' jobs, people's property, et cetera. So I think the bill is fine on that point, Comrade Chair, but it's more about the implementation, et cetera. And Comrade Chair, on the issue of alcohol. So what the bill is doing is to say the current alcohol limit in your blood for 100 milliliters is 0.05 grams of alcohol. It's going to be reduced to 0.02. So I think it does address the issue raised by Honorable Ramatwa that yes, and I think that provision is put there because you do have alcohol and medicine, you do have minor alcohol and food, et cetera, et cetera. So you do allow it. But the idea, Comrade Chair, which we think is a correct one, that it removes ambiguities currently. Because right now there's too much ambiguities with the 0.05, where people think, well, I'm a big physical rugby player type man. I can handle my alcohol, you know? It can't be that ambiguous. People think, well, if I drink beer or a hunter cider or some soft drink, or not soft drink, or a chair, a softer version of alcohol is not so bad as opposed to drinking vodka. People will think that, well, I'm a seasoned drinker, so I can handle my stuff. It only applies to women who are petite, who can't handle it. So we think, Chair, to be fair to everybody, this proposal in the bill is correct. It's unambiguous. It's very clear. I must know, Honorable Chair, that if I'm going out to a restaurant, there must be a designated driver. And I think that's a fair point, Comrade Chair, because how do you balance a social activity like drinking with the lives of people? The fact that we lose 14,000 people a year, that a quarter of that is related to alcohol, et cetera, it shows you the extent of the crisis. We have to be harsh on it. And Comrade Chair, during this past year, at NEDLAC, we've had extensive engagements with the liquor industry about moving us to a new norm. We can't exist with a continued abuse of alcohol. We also can't afford, Comrade Chair, to ban alcohol. That's not sustainable either, and the periodic bans are not sustainable. So we need to find the new normal. And part of the liquor compact we've drafted with the industry and government is about no drinking and driving, and this bill is obviously a key pillar to it. We think it's a fair approach, Chair, it's a fair compromise, etc. Because we do have members who work in the liquor industry as waiters, as farm workers, in the distribution, etc. But we need to find a sustainable solution. Comrade Chair, to Honourable Pete, the 5 versus 10 year renewals. Look, I think for us what's critical there is about filling the vacancies in traffic departments so you reduce the queues, etc. I think around the issue of fake manufacturing car licenses, I think for us what's critical, Chair, and the bill is fine, but it's what's critical is having a national database, an electronic database, which includes all vehicle licenses, which is easily accessible to traffic and police officials. Because currently, the 9 provinces operate almost like 9 independent countries. Chair, I think I might be running out of time, so I'm trying to be very, very quick. Because comrades raised, honourable members raised quite a few issues. Our point, Honourable Chair, to Honourable Mango, on the PDPs, was that, look, I mean, when people get their driver permits, it's a serious responsibility, the PDPs. Often we think it's too lax around the responsibility you're giving to people. It needs to be overhauled and brought into context of the responsibility those drivers have. On the VIP unit, I mean, I think the bill is fine that it specifies the conditions of which emergency vehicles can speed, how can they go through red lights, et cetera. And that speaks to saving lives, it speaks to ambulances, fire vehicles, police vehicles. Maybe it is best to do it under regulations, to say specifically under regulations. I think as the Western Cape Provincial Administration had done, that transporting MECs, ministers, mayors, et cetera, does not constitute an emergency or a vehicle operation. Chair, I'm trying to check if I just left out any questions. I think, Chair, let me stop there. I hope I've answered any questions, and if I haven't, then my apologies, but I hope I've answered all the questions. Thank you, Comrade Chair.
Thanks very much, Comrade Parks, for the presentation. We can assure you as we get down to work on this piece of legislation, we will also take your views as COSATU into serious consideration. We have heard you. We want to thank you for coming to come and also present the view of the workers under COSATU. Otherwise, we wish you a fruitful year, fruitful events as you continue to develop workers of the country. Thank you very much for your presentation. You are liberated from this meeting. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Comrade Chair.
No, thanks very much. We are now ready to have a submission on the National Road Amendment Bill from Mayor Alta Swanepoel. Alta, are you here?
Good morning. Thank you, Chair. Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me?
I can hear you, but I don't see a full picture of your face. I don't know if... Aha.
Is that better?
Is quite good. Let me welcome you and request you to feel at home, relax. We are with you. We are listening attentively. We will definitely ask some clarity-seeking questions right at the end to make sure that we're listening to you. Otherwise, forge ahead. The opportunity is yours.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. I'm just going to share my screen here. Hopefully, you'll be able to see the screen. Can you see my presentation?
It is crystal clear comments on the National Road Traffic Amendment Bill, March 2021, Alta Swanepoel. Ah, la la.
Thank you very much. Can I go ahead?
Yeah.
Thank you. I'll dive right in. Perhaps just from my side, I used to draft legislation, so most of the comments that I will be providing to you is from that angle. If I can start straight away with the provisions as far as the definitions are concerned, we've had quite a few interesting court cases over the last year which have actually affected the legislation. And although the Portfolio Committee has made no changes to the legislation, we're suddenly sitting with a situation that we have quite a few different interpretations to legislation than what we normally had. And that is also part of the presentation, but I'll start with some of the provisions that are currently in the bill. One of the provisions that we've discussed extensively at the Department of Transport and with other authorities is the definitions of a motor vehicle and a pedal cycle. Now, the definitions are the backbone of the legislation, as you all know, and basically the scope of the Road Traffic Act is being determined by the definitions. The definition of motor vehicle has for years been a topic of discussion for the simple reason that the existing definition of a motor vehicle is very, very wide. It tends to include every single type of vehicle that is controlled by way of any self-propelled mechanism, and it includes trailers as well, which do not have an engine, but is also used on the road. The Department of Transport, as part of the bill, proposed that the legislation be amended to create a new type of pedal cycle, which is partly controlled by a motor, and that cannot exceed 45 kilometers an hour. And they've also proposed a new definition for a pedal cycle. Unfortunately, if you look at the two definitions, it creates a bit of a gap as far as the vehicles are concerned, because if you then create a pedal cycle with an engine that travels between 26 and 44 kilometers an hour, it will not be covered by the legislation at all, which I think was just something that one needs to accommodate. During this process of investigating what this definition should look like, one of the things that we discovered was also that the road infrastructure policy, which is developed by the Road Infrastructure Guys at the Department of Transport, has also created a definition for what they see as non-motorized transport. And the non-motorized transport provisions actually also includes vehicles which are motorized. Now, I know that sounds a little strange, but internationally that term of NMT vehicles are being used for your small vehicles which single persons use for their last mile transport or for slow speed transport, etc. These vehicles generally do not conform to our normal rules for motor vehicles. They cannot comply with homologation, they do not have the same crash test requirements and all those kind of things. So obviously they're less safe to use. They cannot compete with the normal vehicles on the road. And as part of the infrastructure policy, the provision of additional infrastructure to accommodate these vehicles so that you have environmentally friendly vehicles where people can actually be more mobile than just having to walk somewhere, that be included. So if you look at the road infrastructure policy, you'll see that as part of my proposal, there's quite a few pages on this in there. I just pulled out the last bit, which is relevant as far as this morning session is concerned, where they're stating that vehicles which are then propelled by different types of energy sources and that cannot exceed a top speed of 35 kilometers an hour should be included as vehicles which form part of vehicles that are not considered conventional motor vehicles and that the normal homologation, registration and licensing requirements and those do not conform with. Over and above that, we also have the National Land Transport Act, which went through the Portfolio Committee last year and which is still with the President, as I understand. And in that legislation, definitions were made for non-motorized transport that does not include any motorized vehicles. So that would not include like a power-assisted pedal cycle, a Segway, these small little vehicles that are currently being used, unfortunately, illegally, because the legislation currently says they're all motor vehicles and they must all conform to the normal rules, and they can't. They cannot pass homologation tests. So all of these actually present different definitions of what is considered to be this non-motorized vehicles. UNIDO, the United Nations Industrial Development Organization, then in 2015, they commented on the provisions as far as the Green Paper on road infrastructure policy is concerned and the definitions there. And they proposed a definition through that process. I think it was finalized in 2018, where they requested the department to create a definition that also covers these environmentally friendly small vehicles and your pedal assisted vehicles. The definition that you see on your screens there is the definition that they then proposed, where you have power assisted vehicles, which are excluded from the definition of a motor vehicle, as well as these environmentally friendly vehicles. We've taken that definition and just added a few provisions to that. Because of the fact that there are so many of these little types of vehicles out there, it is very difficult within the portfolio committee to determine all the characteristics that these vehicles should have to comply. Because some of them would not have pedals, for example. Others would have throttle controls. Some of them would be a vehicle that allows more than one person on, etc. But all of these may, for future purposes, perhaps be desirable to allow people to be more mobile. And as long as the definition of a motor vehicle includes these vehicles, they have to go through a process of homologation. They have to comply with all the requirements as far as the South African national standards are concerned. And then many of these vehicles will simply fail and not comply with it. In overseas countries, there's currently lots of investigations on this. Germany, Denmark, England, all those countries are currently looking at allowing these vehicles on their sidewalks together with their pedestrians and their cyclists to try and create a more mobile environment where people do not have to use a normal conventional motor car, which is less environmentally friendly. So the proposal is to create a definition that although you do not put all the characteristics into the Act at this point in time, you have room in the regulations later on to accommodate these vehicles. And as developments take place and there are more vehicles that can comply with these kind of requirements, that by way of regulation one can add them and say they are not a conventional motor vehicle, but you have additional requirements for them. It's not a free-for-all and everybody can just drive like I want out there, because more and more overseas countries are also controlling these vehicles and they are making them register and license, etc., although they require less safety requirements for them than the conventional vehicles. So those two definitions then would achieve that if that is considered. The next one is just a technicality, the ambulance definition. The original bill was actually drafted some time ago and the regulations changed to a 2018 and not 2016. So that was just a small one. The next one deals with public roads. As part of my submission, I indicated to the committee that there's been a court case last year, actually two of them, Mount Edgecombe court case, where after a long session, it ended up in the appeal court, and the appeal court made a decision to say that all gated estates, if you have a gated estate and the roads within that gated estate is privately maintained, etc., then those roads do not form part of the road traffic legislation. Now, perhaps just to give you 1 second of background on this, the definition of a public road has never indicated that the ownership of the road is relevant. The protection of the Road Traffic Act is afforded to anyone who is sharing roads with other people. So the moment you are driving on a road and there are other traffic on that road, they want that person to have a roadworthy vehicle and to have a driving license and conform in a certain manner. The moment you argue that a road is not a public road, none of these requirements apply. So all these rules that have been discussed this morning here on drunken driving and having a driving license and all those kind of things are not relevant the moment you are driving on a road which is regarded as private. That is why a farmer can have his eight-year-old son drive his tractor on the farm. There's no other traffic in the vicinity. And if he is responsible for him on that property, no one else is being endangered in the process. Many of the estates we currently have out there have got literally thousands of people living there, and they have hundreds of kilometers of roads in some of these estates. The court case of Mount Edgecombe indicated that the moment there's a gated estate and there's controls that you have to go through and the roads on the other side of that estate is being managed by a homeowners association, then the Road Traffic Act does not apply. Because the argument in this case was that the homeowners association did not apply for permission for road traffic signs to lower the speed limit, and they have their own internal police force there charging people for doing 30 in the 20 zone, etc. And the result of that is that we now have very, very many estates out there that fall outside of the legislation. Some of them were caught unawares because they did not realize this. And as we have a presumption in the Road Traffic Act that says all the roads in the country are presumed to be public roads, if someone wants to argue something is not public, they have to come and prove it. It basically means that within those estates, all of the estates must now create their own set of rules. And the other thing is third parties that come and visit, they have no real control over them. They have control via contract with the person who owns property in that estate. But third parties that come and visit would be the responsibility of the person who comes and visits. This creates a very strange situation. Theoretically, if you look at it, road traffic accidents or crashes happen on public roads. So if someone makes an accident in one of these estates, they should not be reporting it to the police because it is no longer in on a public road if the argument of the case in Mount Edgecombe is accepted. Just a little bit later during the year, there was a case in Bele versus Road Accident Fund, and in that case, the courts ruled that the area beyond the boom gates at the Cape Town port is actually public road, and that the person whose husband died in an accident on those roads could actually claim from the Road Accident Fund. So during the course of the same year, we had two appeal court cases where one said gated estates where there's a boom gate and access control, the roads on the other side are not public. And in the other case, it said, well, there's a boom gate, there's access control. It's not a residential estate on the other side, but it's the Cape Town port. And that is actually a public road. And these two cases, I feel, would create a lot of uncertainty out there. And perhaps the portfolio committee could make a decision in this regard to say, what is the situation? Are these roads considered to be public roads? Do you want the Road Traffic Act to apply there or not? And on account of that, perhaps change provisions in the legislation. I did include in my presentation two options, just to say, how would one change the public road definition? Either saying gated estates and boom areas that are falling under the prescribed requirements are included under the definition of public road or not, depending on which direction you want to go in this regard. So that basically is just because of court cases, there's been no change to the legislation, but the court cases have resulted in a situation, as it's an appeal case, any magistrate in any case must follow those cases. But it now depends which one of the two they would actually go for when they make an argument in this regard. And I feel it is a very important definition as it determines the entire scope of the Road Traffic Act. So there shouldn't be any ambiguity as far as this is concerned. Then the other one that happened in January, I apologize, this is not in the presentation to the portfolio committee, was the definition of driver, vehicle and trailer as far as the Brackenfell trailer case is concerned. In this case, it is again, Kasatu alluded to the fact that in some cases, the results of legislation is what is being managed and the legislation itself does not need to be changed to ensure that something changes. What happened in this specific case is that Brackenfell trailers were getting a lot of fines from people renting their trailers. And because of the fact that they redirected the fines to the drivers, the Cape Town City did not redirect them. And they went to court and said, but as the trailer owner, they should not be responsible to tell the authorities who's driving that vehicle. And they won the case in the High Court. They appealed to the Supreme Court. The Department of Transport appealed to the Supreme Court of Appeal to overthrow this, and unfortunately, they lost the case. If you look at the arguments that the judges made, it is interesting in the sense that they were saying that Section 73 of the Road Traffic Act, if I can perhaps just put that on the screen there for you, where it says that if there's a prosecution and the authorities do not know who drove the vehicle, then they assume it is the owner. This is the backbone of this legislation. It was challenged in the Constitutional Court years ago, the State versus Meeker case, and it was found to be constitutional. There's no way law enforcement can take place if it is not the responsibility of the owner of the vehicle to tell the authorities who's driving that vehicle. And in terms of this, Subsection 2 deals with parking, to say if the vehicle is parked, they do not know it's responsible, then it is assumed it's the owner. And Sub 3 just deals with corporate bodies where the same provision apply. Due to the appeal case of the Brackenfell trailer case now, the court has made a decision that while a vehicle is being drawn by another vehicle on a public road, the owner of the trailer does not need to tell the authorities who's driving that vehicle. Now, in the case where they are saying that for speeding cases, for example, traffic departments need to take a picture of the vehicle that is drawing the trailer, and then they must in that way charge the driver. Unfortunately, it's not only speeding cases where these things apply. You may be the witness of an incident where a person with a trailer drives over a red traffic signal, kills someone and drives away. And if you only have the number plate of the trailer, then in terms of the latest interpretation of this legislation, the person who owns that trailer does not have to tell the authorities who was driving that vehicle. In the case where the vehicle is parked, then the court has made a decision, the appeal court has said, in that circumstances, now the owner of the trailer has to tell the authorities who parked the vehicle there. But while it is being used on a public road, they do not see the vehicle as being driven. It is being drawn, and that was never the intention of the legislator. If you look at the definitions of driver and vehicle and motor vehicle, trailers have been included as motor vehicles all the time, and a driver of a vehicle is anyone who takes a vehicle onto a road. It's even taking it so far to say, if you are driving a flock of animals across the road, you are seen as a driver. So the provision of the appeal court has now said that if you have a trailer behind a vehicle, it may be your own trailer, you do not need to tell the authorities who was driving that vehicle. At the same time, this act currently has provisions in trying to tighten license number plates and so forth. And the sole purpose of that is to identify who's using vehicles. If this case stands, it means we will have a long set of rules as far as number plates are concerned to ensure that people do not have false plates on their vehicles, etc. But you can have a legitimate owner of a trailer who has no obligation to tell the authorities who's driving that vehicle. I would suggest that Section 73 is amended to make it very clear that if you have a trailer on the road, you also need to tell the authorities who's driving that vehicle. The problem is not with the legislation. It is with the way in which people who are redirecting the traffic fines are dealing with those fines. It is not the issue of the legislation that is the problem here. Then, as far as the next provision is concerned, this is just, I think, something that was omitted. The previous provisions of a driving instructor, which is a person who trains people to get their driving licenses, the provision in the section on the definition says, an instructor is someone that is appointed under or registered under Section 28B, but when you get to Section 28B, there are no requirements for who this driving instructor should be. I just think either in the definition or in Section 28B, the legislation should be clear who is an instructor. Otherwise, the normal dictionary meaning applies, and that won't be sufficient in this case because you get instructors in the Army and you get instructors in different places. This specific instructor is someone who is teaching people to drive. And somewhere the legislation should actually say that. Then as far as Section 3I is concerned, I heard the previous speaker also allude to this. I just suggest that technically this is not necessary. All traffic officers are already peace officers in terms of the Criminal Procedure Act, and they have the power to impound vehicles in terms of Section 20 of the Criminal Procedure Act. However, the provision has been put into this legislation, but there's no provision in here to say what do they do with the vehicles once they have actually impounded them. I would suggest that something is added here, or it can be repeated in this legislation, but Section 3236 of the Criminal Procedure Act has extensive provisions in to say once a peace officer or a police officer or someone has impounded something, what must they do with it? Because there's a lot of obligations that come with that. When you impound something, you become responsible for it. And in terms of this legislation, the power to impound is there, but not to empower the instruction of what to do once you have impounded the vehicle. The next provisions are also just terminology. The Road Traffic Act everywhere refers to registering authorities and not municipalities, and it's defined like that as well. So as far as the local authority and registering authorities are concerned, I think it's just necessary to use the terminology that is in the legislation. The next one is also just a statement there that it shouldn't say on but from, on number 23. Clause 28 is the next one that I submitted a separate provision to the Portfolio Committee on. during the course of the R2 discussions, I think many of the members of the National Council of Provinces, etc., that were part of those processes, also heard the many complaints that people had about foreign drivers and the discrepancies that that's there for foreign drivers and for South African drivers. Currently, our road traffic legislation is very friendly. We are one of the very few countries in the world that allow anyone from any country in the world to use their driving license in our country. Most other countries, there are three conventions that is mentioned in the legislation that were signed, and all the countries that signed those conventions, their drivers are allowed to drive in other countries because they have agreed to a set of rules of testing and of ensuring the person is capable to drive. All countries in the world do not have these rules. However, it creates a problem as far as foreign drivers working in South Africa is concerned and driving here all the time. Our borders, as everyone knows, is very popular and everyone comes into our country. And because of that, we have a scenario, we have lots of foreign drivers driving here. And many of them are driving with foreign documents, which are similar to professional driving permits, etc., but they don't always conform to our legislation. The other problem is trying to charge someone in our country for a traffic infringement and then having to try and follow it up later is very difficult because of all the foreign documentation that people have. So we're suggesting that we already have a document in the road traffic legislation. It's called the Traffic Register Number Certificate, and it is a document that foreigners can get if they want to come and buy a vehicle in South Africa or get a professional driving permit. That one provides for provisions in the legislation to allow the minister to prescribe additional requirements than the driving license for foreigners. And when the R2 system is fully implemented and the demerit point is in place, it would be possible to require all foreigners when they either rent a vehicle or they come through the border with the new border management guys to be issued with this document. It's free of charge. It's issued on account of a passport or a foreign ID. And that they then have a South African equivalent of a document that can be used to identify them. This document could also carry the demerit points. And all the arguments South African drivers have that the foreigners are then in a better position than they are as far as getting demerit points and so forth are concerned under the R2 system could then be solved in this manner. So the Act only needs to provide for a provision that the minister is allowed to make a regulation in this regard. But the proposal that I have submitted, that's the second proposal in January, also contained the various regulations that could be amended to accommodate this proposal. Foreign drivers, again, together with this, also as far as professional driving car permits are concerned, is currently a problem in the sense that there are 10 countries which are defined in the National Road Traffic Act as prescribed territories. They are listed there on the slide for you. And people who are coming to South Africa from those countries are considered to have professional driving permits if their own country has a similar document. Like Zimbabwe has a defensive driving certificate. And many of them are being employed by South African companies and they are driving here. It, however, creates a lot of arguments all the time from a legal perspective if they are allowed to drive, etc. As, for example, in South Africa, dangerous goods drivers meet additional training requirements before they are allowed to transport dangerous goods. Our neighboring states do not have those rules. So you find that many of these things are very ambiguous and the traffic officers are in many instances confronted with having to interpret the legislation. It would be quite a bit easier to make it very straightforward and say the following countries' documents are allowed, or if you want to come and drive a truck in South Africa, you need to come and get a South African driving license and professional driving permit. Whatever the committee decides in this regard, I think Section 32 of the Road Traffic Act perhaps needs to be clearer on who is allowed. The other thing that the committee should consider is that the tripartite agreement that South Africa is now part of actually includes many more countries than the 10 which are listed in the prescribed territories. I think there are 27 countries right up from Ethiopia down which are part of this process. And if in future their documents are going to be acceptable here and our documents are going to be acceptable there, it may be worthwhile either changing the prescribed territory definition to say and other prescribed countries. Otherwise, one will have to come back to Parliament to amend this definition at the stage when all of these this legislation is finalised. The last few, as far as the provisions are concerned, Just some wording as far as incidents are concerned. In some places it's referred to as a road incident and other places as an incident, just as far as the provisions concerned there to formalize that. Then as far as the alcohol provision is concerned, I know many people have views on that and you have very many presentations on this. I'm not talking about the zero limit. All I want to allude to is if you look at the existing provision in the legislation, Section 35 of the Road Traffic Act actually states that if a person has been convicted of Section 65, then his driving license will automatically be suspended for a period of 6 months for a first offence, 5 years for a second offence, and 10 years for a third offence. I'm just suggesting that in the event that you are looking at this, to perhaps then, as this is a very harsh provision, then introduce those provisions that were in Section 65 as the starting point for when a person gets prosecuted, to put that in here and say a person's license would only be automatically suspended when he actually exceeds these provisions. Otherwise, you may sit with a situation where somebody literally had one beer and he may be sitting without a driving license for 6 months. In that regard, also, there is actually an error in Section 35. Section 35, under paragraph AA that were added some years ago, Section 59.4 relates to all types of speed limit. So that is speed limits that the minister introduces for special vehicles like 84 trucks and 100 for buses, as well as the general speed limit, as well as speed limits on road traffic signs. And I think somewhere a mistake just slipped in and the term general speed limit was added to sub 1 and sub 2. That should be removed because it is actually wrong. Section 59.4 deals with all of those types of speed limits, not only general speed limits. The powers of the minister, in terms of provisions that were published in the national legislation in 2014 in the regulations, the Minister of Transport published regulations on controlling driving hours of trucks and buses. However, the state law advisor at the time said that those regulations could not be put into force because there's no specific power for the minister to make those regulations. Since then, they've not been retracted. They have been part of the legislation, but they've just never been included. And I see that the latest bill does not have a power for the minister in to actually make regulations on this. So the suggestion is that both those environmentally friendly vehicles, if you decide to change the definition of motor vehicle, as well as provisions to allow the minister to make regulations on driving hours, be included into Section 75, which would then give the minister the power to, first of all, introduce those sections, those regulations which are in the legislation for the last 6 years, and also then make new regulations for environmentally friendly vehicles. The last provision here, Section 80, that deals with parking for disabled persons, this legislation was pulled from the provincial acts into the national legislation. Unfortunately, the laws of the provinces were supposed to continue to make rules as far as parking for disabled persons are concerned to ensure that if one authority issues a disc for a person to park in a disabled parking spot, you could actually use it in another town. There's no requirement that the minister may make regulations in this regard, and it was never actually taken up in the provincial legislation. So the same thing happened here. The regulations were published in 2014 to allow for application procedures, discs, etc., for parking for disabled persons, but there was no power in the Act for the minister to enact those regulations. If you change Section 80 to simply say that the prescribed requirements would be in place instead of the laws of a province, it would mean that the minister can actually implement those regulations as far as those provisions are concerned. That's basically it. Hopefully I did not take too much time. Thank you.
No, I was a bit lenient. You have not taken much out of your time. But it's okay. I was enjoying the details that you were giving in terms of what you propose to be looked into. Thank you very much, Alta, for the detailed presentation. As I've indicated earlier on, there will definitely be people who want to interact with you, honorable members from this committee. I already have three of them. I'll be calling their names, so prepare yourself.
100%. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Honorable Hunsinger, followed by Honorable McDonald and Honorable Mangu, followed by somebody who like raising his hand when other people have been pointed. Honorable Mapena, and that's it. Let's forget, honorable members.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you for the submission. This is Alta Swanepoel. You made use of examples that I found very useful, you know, on the public road definition, as well as on Section 73. And with that, you actually showed out many gaps and shortfalls. In general, I wanted to thank you for the time that you took and for the effort in analyzing everything and pointing everything out. Chairperson, I don't have any questions and just huge appreciation for the submission of Ms. Swanepoel. In having previous experience with her, I expected nothing less. Thank you for the huge contribution to widen our thinking and give us particular insight. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Member, for the appreciation on behalf of the whole committee. We also feel the same. Honorable McDonald.
Chairperson, thank you very much. Let me echo the sentiments of my colleague here, Honorable Hunsinger. Bye, Donkey Alta. It was very informative information. And I echo many of those things that you have raised, and I have raised them on several occasions myself, relating to the PDPs, that it's way too easy for a foreign national to get a PDP in this country. And I think you are 100% correct in stating that those parts of the legislation need serious review. As more and more people are dying in this country on the roads due to people that are not trained sufficiently driving trucks that are excessively heavy and killing people and maiming people. An example is this weekend's truck accident in Sandton. Chairperson, through you also, I'm also very interested in your observations regarding Section 73 and also your very extensive insights in the driving under the alcohol limits, and I fully agree with you that we need to look at that, and I think because of lack of enforcement, we are not enforcing these sections in that are already there, and it's causing a big problem for us as South Africans. But I also want to just your insights on truck and trailers. You can now buy, for an example, a 10-ton closed body truck, and then which has got a maximum limit of truck and cargo of around 14,000 kilograms with 14 tons. That's truck and which is a 10-ton rated truck. But then you can buy another 10-ton trailer, hook that to the 10-ton truck, and now you have 20 tons on the road. Although the trailer is brake assisted, your limitations on there is only 10 tons, and it's 100% legal in this country. And I just wanted to know if you've got any suggestions on this type of blatant infringements that are actually under the current law not infringements. I thank you very much, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Honorable McDonald. Jamba.
Thank you very much, Chair. Good morning, Alta. Nice seeing you after many, many years. And yes, as passionate as always about road traffic, I could not echo better the words of my colleague that I didn't expect anything less from you. So unfortunately, that causes me to want to stretch your thinking or abuse your thinking. Now, here are a couple of things I wanted to raise with you, just to pick your mind there. Number one, the issue of PRDPs. You mentioned crossing easily into our country. What is your view as it relates to the protocols and the agreements we have signed as it relates particularly to SACO and SADC protocols? How do you think that would impact your suggestion if it were to be carried through of what should happen to professional drivers? I'm confining myself to those two in the main because I think those are the most drivers that come across our borders. Secondly, there is a serious problem. It's easy for people to come and say or talk about corruption, but few real suggestions. Now, there are two areas that are of major concern to me. And the question to you is, do you think legislation could be introduced that assists us to arrest that? One, roadworthiness testing. Many vehicles do not even go to a roadworthiness testing station. The SABS, if they are still the inspectorate, does almost zero. What is it that could be done in legislation? For instance, in I think it's Sweden and Netherlands, the process is totally automated. You can pick up a vehicle as it enters if it is really in natives or not. Is it a yellow Toyota or not? Simply put, in legislation, is there anything you think could be done in terms of addressing the roadworthiness corruption? In essence, removing the human element as much as it is humanly possible. That would link me to the issue of drivers, I mean police, traffic police, traffic officers, whatever you want to call them, body cameras, cameras in their vehicles to be able to monitor anything they do. What is your view there? Is it something that could be considered? In terms of dealing with the whole issue of corruption. Now, especially in Tshwane, Pretoria, I've not seen it in many places, there has been a start of the coming in of these three wheelers that are beginning to be used as public transport vehicles or as taxis. And this is on top of the e-hailing problem that we are already having grappling with. Is there anything that we should allow three-wheelers to be used as public transport? Most of them don't even have a closed site. They are using a canvas just to close the site, and they load people as taxis. Any thoughts, any views around that? And now, last but not least, you spoke about the trailers, the many examples you made about the obligation of a owner of a taxi to disclose information and everything. Now, there is an issue currently of people whose vehicles are blocked if you have not renewed a license for another one or traffic fines. Wouldn't that maybe be extended easier to do that in that? But what can we do? We never knew that there will be an epidemic. We never knew that traffic licensing places will be closed, but the reality is that people's licenses were not renewed, vehicles and otherwise, and they are paying penalties for something that is not their fault. But people are paying penalties because they couldn't renew their licenses when their licenses expired. Your thoughts in that area, Alta, will be appreciated. Thank you so much, Chairperson.
Thank you so much, Honorable Member Manu. Our last speaker on this list will be Ubaba Umabhena.
Thank you very much, Chairperson Mthokozi. Even though you're holding jabs at me this morning, but it's okay. I'll take them on the chin. There's no crisis. It's fine. Good morning, Alta. I think I just want to expand on the issue of the private roads. I think you've mentioned the fact that in South Africa, there's literally about thousands of private roads. I think when you mention this, it reminds me of the city of Johannesburg precinct. as you enter, as you are driving on a road which leads you to the Johannesburg Theater. But there's a small road there that takes you into the Johannesburg precinct. As you go on the side of the council chamber, there are two issues with that road. One, it leads you into a public institution, and that road is used by hundreds and hundreds of workers on a daily basis. But that road is a private road, and that road is used by multiple number of vehicles. If an accident was to happen on that road, from what you are saying, is that basically the legislation does not cover people who are on that road because of the shortfalls which are there within legislation. But what I wanted to also check is, you've made mention of the fact of the farmers within farms, which have also private roads, and they use their tractors. And also you've made mention of the thousands and thousands of estates which do exist in South Africa, and that in essence, in a farm, a farmer would not need or a farmer would not be placing anyone's life in danger, because they'd be driving on a farm road which the only danger which they place is just on themselves. But then in an instance where it is an estate, you find that there are thousands and thousands of people there. So even when you're driving there, you are placing those people into a potential of accidents harming themselves. So what I want to check is, in terms of your own thinking and contribution, what should be done? What's the recommendation there? Do these roads need to be reclassified, or do you need to strengthen legislation to also cover those private roads, in essence making them public roads, even though they are within private property, and to make sure that even when there are issues of incidents and anything else, that those are also covered. And also, if you look at, for instance, where I come from in Mpumalanga, where we have small plots and some sort of farms, those farms are within private properties. And myself as well, when I enter into our family type of homestead there, technically, legislation, according to what you're saying, does not cover me. So I just want to check in terms of, what is your recommendation there? Do we need to reclassify these private roads? If yes, how will we do that? Because those belong to private individuals and corporates, will be encroaching on the rights of people who own private properties. But then if you also do extension of legislation, are we not opening ourselves up for potential litigation from those private holdings and those individuals who own those small farms and plots? But also, obviously, one thing that we need to put first, which must come first, is to ensure that citizens are protected, and that citizens are not placed in harm's way in any way. So if that can be done through to strengthening legislation, how can we do it in such a way that we don't open ourselves up for litigation in future? Thank you so much, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Member. Mayor Alda Swanepoel. People normally, the Sotho speaking people, when they pronounce my surname, they say Swane. So I just need to add Pool on the other side, then so we're on the same level. Can you point ahead and try and respond to members? Thank you.
Thank you very much. The Americans called us swimming pools when we were there. So, just on the first question, as far as the vehicles are concerned, with the 10-ton trailers at the back, the road traffic legislation makes provision for the fact that you can have a trailer at the back of a vehicle due to your driving license requirements, and the gross combination mass of a vehicle applies under those circumstances. So if a person has a 10-ton vehicle and he goes and hitches a 10-ton trailer at the back, if he doesn't have the right license for it, and if the vehicle does not have the necessary gross combination mass, then that would be an illegal combination. So there is sufficient legislation to cover that. If I can just start with that one. The second set of questions dealing with the corruption, my personal view is, if you look at the road traffic legislation of years ago, driving license applications were restricted to the authority where the person lived. Vehicle testing was restricted to the area where the person lived, as well as the registration and licensing of vehicles. And over the years, the legislation was changed. You still are compelled, as far as registration and licensing is concerned, to stay within your own area and license your vehicle there. But roadworthy testing and driving license testing was thrown open and you could go anywhere. So if you now look at the inspectorates that need to go and investigate guys who issue false driving licenses and false vehicle licenses, they have the entire country that they need to go and investigate to find out where this person was actually responsible for whatever he's done. So to limit the area where a person is allowed to go, and to limit the area where you need to have the investigations and the control, and to also be in a position to say to the local authority, you have X number of people living in this area, you have X number of vehicles here that need to get for roadworthy testing every year, you need X number of vehicles that need to be registered and licensed. This is the infrastructure you require to be able to do this job. Then you have limited the area where the person can go, because why on earth would someone that lives in Pretoria drive to East London to have his truck roadworthy there? There's only one reason for that, is that truck never went there. Somebody issued that license, that vehicle roadworthy for him without him being there. If we get to a situation where you force the guys back to the area where they live, you first of all allow your local authorities to plan, because now they know how many people have to be in the area. What we're currently sitting with is many of our driving license testing centers have five driving license examiners. But the people in the area, there are millions of people living there and they need driving licenses. But because people can shop around in terms of the legislation as it stands at the moment, you can't compel them to say, you need to have X number of people available to do this job because you have a steady stream of people coming here. Your roadworthies are the same. The only legislation I can think of where you can try and force these guys to comply with legislation better is if you enclose the area where people can do stuff like this. There's no reason why you need to go outside your area for these kind of things. And we, in any case, force people to go and get their registration and licensing there. And then we've seen now under these provisions of COVID that the authorities that are operating on a third of the staff, et cetera, simply do not have the capacity to deal with these things. Having roadworthy applications done online, back office, I personally feel the legislation already allows for it. There's lots of regulations that have not been put into force to allow web-based applications. Regulation 13, there's a number of road traffic regulations allowing for applications to be done online for change of ownership, change of those kind of things where you can do it online and the documentation can be sent to you afterwards. Obviously, we can't allow someone to print their own license disc because those are watermark papers, but there's set of controls for that. But taking the application process out of standing in a queue, I think we're there. We have the entire RTMC with natives that can do these things. You can already go online, natives, go and see what vehicle licenses are outstanding, make an application. If that is properly managed and it is extended to that everybody can have access to it, one would be able to get people out of the walls and queues at the registering authorities. And if you want to control them better, as far as driving licenses and vehicle licenses are concerned, stick to where they live. Don't let them shop around for licenses, because that is when they get to the Skellums and that is when the Skellums issue them licenses without them being present. The other thing that I think is, one of the things that I think there's a very one-sided approach to corruption and bribery. Traffic officers are not corrupt on their own. Somebody needs to give them money. So the moment you have somebody telling you around the bright lights fire that they have just paid a traffic officer, they have admitted to a criminal offense. And what we find is, from that side, there's very little consequence. They should start setting traps. People should know that the opportunity is there, that if I'm giving this officer money, I'm going to spend time in jail, because currently that is not happening. In a few instances, the traffic officers are prosecuted for bribery if they do catch them. But I believe we should take away the market. What we're currently sitting with is people that are not scared if they are giving a traffic officer money because absolutely nothing happens to them. We are unfortunately very much a country of no consequences, and you can see that very much in the way our people drive. So from that perspective, the Criminal Procedure Act makes provision for the fact that as long as you warn people, you can set traps. Set traps, get the guys, make them scared to give traffic officers money. Because if we don't do that, when R2 is implemented and they have an additional worry that they're going to get demerit points, this problem is not going to go away. It's going to be worse. So we must create a scenario where people are scared to give traffic officers money because they do not know, is this the real thing or is this guy actually trying to get me to pay and then I'm going to spend some time in jail. So you can never legislate for corruption. That's not possible. You can only do so much. But that is basically it. I don't think I missed any of the questions. Sorry, the last one was the PRDPs. I think as far as SACU is concerned on the PRDPs, we are not suggesting that their PRDPs are not acceptable. We are suggesting an additional form of identification, and then we control the additional form of identification. So I know it's a technicality, but I think one would be able to say we are not transgressing any provisions that we have with the existing SACU countries as far as that is concerned. Thank you. Hopefully I answered everything.
Right on time. Alta, thank you very much for you're being well prepared. I'm sure we are more enlightened, and because of time constraints, I know you have not answered the question of Honorable Mabena, but I want to say sorry to him because Leighton Beard is already ready. And this is his lot. And thank you very much. You are released.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Mr. Leighton Beard, good morning, sir.
Good morning, Chair. Thank you very much for this opportunity. I'm prepared to allow Ms. Swanepoel to answer Mr. Mabena's question if she wants to do that.
Thank you very much for your kindness, although that will... come back to bite you a bit. Alta, can you quickly answer the small road in Johannesburg that leads to the Prinsic?
100%. Yes, as I've explained to you, technically there are two things as far as roads are concerned. The one is the infrastructure. Infrastructure is the responsibility of the owner of that property. And there's roads laws that deal with that. The Road Traffic Act deals with the use of the road, whether it's private or public. And the principle in the legislation has always been that it doesn't matter whether a road is private or public owned. It is who uses that road. And if you look at the provision, it says if a part of the public is using a road, it should be a public road. So before the Mount Edgecombe case, the argument has always been, if you have an accident in Pick and Place parking area or on that small road where you've gone through a boom gate and you are in the Joburg municipal area, you are on a public road. What has happened now is the Mount Edgecombe case has said that if there's access control, even if and the part of the public that goes through those gates on the other side, are 10,000, they are still on because of access control, they are now on a private road, which never was the intention of the legislator because there was a presumption that said all roads are considered public. So I would suggest to create the scenario that was there before is to provide for in the definition of a public road to say, depending on what kind of access control is available and to make that prescribed, because you can have areas where you only have two houses and they share a gate. I would not suggest that the road on the other side there is public road. But if you have a scenario where you have like a gated estate and there's 1,000 people going through those gates every day, that the same protection that is afforded to people on public roads should be afforded to them on those roads as well. If you look at other acts, the Occupational Safety Act, the Labour Act, etc., they do not stop where the public road stops. So if you are working in a gated estate, the rules as far as how you should be employed, etc., still applies, although you are in a private estate. But now, because of this court case, the rules on being protected because of the road traffic legislation, that has stopped because they say on the other side the roads are private. So I would try and change the definition back to what was always intended, where you have a mix of traffic, even if it's only a part of the public, that they should be controlled by the road traffic legislation and they should not be allowed to make their own rules. Because remember, just one last thing, I apologize. On many of these estates now, if you go and read the newspapers and stuff, they have their own police forces there and they have their own traffic fine systems and stuff. They have speed limits of 20, and if you drive 30, you get R1,000 fine. They lock you out of estates if you do not comply, etc. So you have a very interesting scenario that is happening there, whereas if these were public roads, traffic officers would have to do the law enforcement there. So those are the things that one would need to consider if you decide to open up this definition to say who does the law enforcement there and what kind of provisions need to be in place. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thank you very much, Alta. Thank you very much to Mr. Leighton Beard, who's making submission on behalf of the Automobile Association of South Africa from 10:40 to 11 hours on the dot. Thank you very much, sir. You can forge ahead.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Let me just share my screen. There we go. Can everybody see that screen?
No. Yeah. We now can see the screen clearly and everybody that is next to the screen, including myself. Thank you
Excellent. Very much.
Go ahead.
Thank you very much. And thank you very much for the opportunity that has been afforded to the AA to make the submission. We are very grateful for this opportunity. Let me just move this out of the way first, because that's going to get in the way. So our view is that national road traffic legislation should advance road safety to prevent injuries and death, advance an approach dealing with all aspects of road safety, roads, users, vehicles, post-crash intervention. It should be punitive on offenders, but create an environment that is conducive for non-offenders. And by the way, when I speak of users, I'm speaking of all road users. I'm speaking of pedestrians, motorists, passengers, commuters, people on motorbikes, on cycles. So it's the whole gamut of road users. National road traffic legislation should clearly outline its objectives, and it should be transparent in motivating any decisions that are taken. And it should be, in our view, consistent in its application. It is within this framework that the AA makes the following submissions in relation to the NRTA here today. We've highlighted a few issues. I will go through some of these a little faster, Chair, but there is naturally an issue that is more relevant for us, and we believe motorists than the others. But I'll run through these very quickly. Our issue with the issue with this issue of microdots is that the detail and proposals are not clear enough for us in this legislation, as is the necessity for these proposals. Microdot security technology is available along with many other forms of security, such as high security locks, electronic alarm immobilizer, satellite tracking, etc. So the question that we have to pose is, no reasons have been provided for the development of the microdot legislation, and we're not sure whether any research has been conducted to support the implementation of the new regulations. If research has been conducted, we believe it should be made public and open to scrutiny. And we also believe that it's premature to link the economic value of microdots to this bill. So in our view, we have concerns that private companies producing microdots run the risk of deregistration, given that no clear guidelines for this registration have been published. Ostensibly, the guidelines will be published in the regulations, and this places them beyond parliamentary scrutiny and therefore operating at the pleasure of the Minister of Transport. We, because of that and because of these issues, request a delay in this process and for more information relating to the microdots be published outlining their intent and rationale. Then we got to the issue of the inspectorate of the DLTCs. The appointments by the Minister of the Inspectorate come after a decision by the Shareholders Committee of the RTMC. Now, that's how it's always been done. The amendment to subsection 11.1 deletes the reference to the Shareholders Committee and provides a free hand to the Minister, removing transparency and denying members of the Shareholders Committee an opportunity to make inputs. Effectively, in our view, this de-democratizes the process.
The AA proposes that the original wording of subsection 11 be retained, and that is amendment of subsection 11 of Act 93 of 96, and then it goes further down. The minister shall, and then we believe this should be included, after decision has been taken by the Shareholders Committee, appoint a person and authority or body as an inspectorate of driving license testing centres. The license verification issue, currently legislation prevents the owner, operator or person in charge from allowing an unlicensed person to drive on public roads. New subsection is onerous and requires owner or operator to take steps to ensure a driver is licensed accordingly. Now that's problematic for us because that means that it could be interpreted to mean the duty is imposed on the owner, operator or person in charge to assist a person obtain a license. That for us is a concern. We propose the paragraph be reworded to say the owner or operator shall, before the person referred to in subsection 1 drives a vehicle as contemplated in subsection 1, verify that such a person is licensed accordingly. We believe that would clarify the issue, and it takes that onerous requirement of the owner or operator for that person to obtain a license out of the picture. The grading of driving instructors is a very important issue for us. It makes provision for the grading of driving instructors, and it will require tests beyond the current driver license instructors test. The current standard is inadequate and weak, and it runs parallel to the problem of the current driving license test, the K53, which is outdated and does not reflect the current state of vehicle technologies. The grading of driving instructors is wholly dependent on the quality of test that they are preparing drivers for. So if the test is inadequate, then the training you're going to be giving to the instructors will also similarly be inadequate. So both of these need to be run concurrently, and they both need to be improved. We believe that the grading of instructors is premature. We're not opposed to the introduction, but it cannot happen without a review of the current K53 testing. The review of the current test should inform any changes to driver instructor legislation. And unless that happens quickly, we're going to be losing more lives on our roads, as many of the speakers have alluded to today. This issue of the response to road incidents, and I'll go through this very quickly. The proposed amendments create an onus on emergency services to respond to road incidents and render all the necessary services as prescribed. This creates a new definition, in our view, of emergency services. Now, for us, this appears to compel private emergency services to respond to road incidents, but it lacks detail on cost and utilization aspects. The presumption is that necessary services will be prescribed in the regulations, which is a concerning development. Emergency services personnel are best placed to make decisions on services rendered. The amendment could outsource that incident response to the private sector, and that would be a threat to state emergency services. The private sector could reduce its capacity if compelled to respond at a loss. In other words, if this issue of the cost and utilization is not resolved, private emergency services may have to reduce because they are not being paid the same amounts as what they would for other services. We propose that this section be withdrawn and that a consultative process to clarify government's aims in respect of emergency response to road incidents is rather considered. Now, the reduction of alcohol levels to zero is, I think, the issue that is of most concern to us. The reduction of blood and breath alcohol levels to zero, we believe, is unlikely to achieve substantial positive changes. And I want to stress very clearly, the AA is not promoting drunk driving. We are not promoting drinking and driving. But as I will clarify going forward, we want to pursue a situation where enforcement is ramped up, and that is going to achieve the results we believe that this bill is intended to achieve. We question the purpose and the desired outcomes of the reduction from 0.05 to zero, and I'm specifically referring obviously to drivers and not to professional drivers, but we question why this is being done. And there is no rationale provided in the legislation that explains that. Our question is, how will traffic law enforcement change within a zero alcohol environment? If that traffic law enforcement doesn't change, how will consumer behavior change in relation to drunk driving? What is being done to stigmatize drunk driving currently, and what public education is being done to decrease and prevent this behavior? The fear of being caught is minimal. And if traffic law enforcement does change, why can that change not be made without a legislative change? Critically, what is being done, and this is something that was raised earlier, to deal with drunk walking. And I say drunk walking, but let's call it intoxicated walking, where people are walking either as a result of being intoxicated through drugs or alcohol. Pedestrians are the road user group with the most fatalities on South African roads. And as a previous speaker also pointed out, 40% of all fatalities are a result are pedestrians on our roads. And we have to ask what education and public awareness is being directed specifically at this group ahead of the proposed legislation. There is available research, and I won't go too much in depth. You will have access to this presentation as well as to all the available research. In South Africa, the blood alcohol concentration was reduced from 0.08 to 0.05 in 1999. The NIMH study by the MRC and UNISA indicated that despite the reduction percentage of driver fatalities with BAC above zero, rose from 53.2 in 1999 to 57.6 in 2008. There are international studies which confirm that lowering the BAC does not have the desired outcome. The Scottish study, which was published in the Lancet in 2019, and I'll go directly to that, this is a South African study. This is available. This just reinforces the view that lowering the blood alcohol level in South Africa didn't have a major impact. In fact, the cases increased. The Scottish study, an evaluation of the effects of lowering of blood alcohol concentration limits for drivers on the rates of road traffic accidents and alcohol consumption. Our findings suggest that changing the legal BAC limit for drivers in isolation does not improve road traffic accident outcomes. That's a very important point. We look at the WHO, the World Health Organization. We agree that setting blood alcohol limits is effective in reducing road crashes, but the level of enforcement of drink driving laws has a direct effect on the incidence of drinking and driving. And this comes back to the issue I said earlier, the fear of being caught is minimal. Breath testing devices that provide objective evidence for blood alcohol content are a very effective enforcement tool. And that is something that we have been asking for a very long time. Our position is that legislation without policing is ineffective. when we talk about policing, we have to look at what the Traffic Law Enforcement Review Committee, which is a committee that was established by the minister in 2016. And there is a draft report that has been handed to the minister and to the MECs at the moment. And we believe this is a very important document. And I'd like to extract just a few of the elements that came from that. Driving under the influence of alcohol or drugs is a crime dependent on effective policing for detection. That is a critical statement. South Africa is known globally for having the highest number of road traffic fatalities caused by drunk driving. And I'd like to pause on that. At the moment, we're getting official figures from the Road Traffic Management Corporation. They do not break down the effects of drunk driving on crashes. And in fact, the MRC study also found that more research needs to be done on the effects of alcohol on drunk driving so we can get a clearer picture of exactly what the extent of the problem is. We have no percentages at the moment. There is a problem with the collection of blood samples. The entire chain of evidence is fraught with problems, and it is no wonder that prosecutions and convictions for drunk driving are so low. A perception of omnipresence is essential to curb lawlessness. I won't go into that, but these are some of the things that the Turlek has said. And they finally make a recommendation that the number of traffic officers should be doubled to bring this number up to around 50,000 by 2030. Now, our comments on this is that the proposals do not consider, one, gut fermentation syndrome, also known as autobrewery syndrome. This is a condition where people ingest carbohydrates, and in the gastrointestinal tract, the body converts these into alcohol, and the driver becomes intoxicated without drinking alcohol. The proposals do not consider the use of medication or antiseptic products such as mouthwashes, which contain alcohol, but which will not impair driving. And that's a very important statement. These products may produce positive breath results above zero for drivers who are not intoxicated or impaired. The proposals do not consider the use of alcohol in religious activities, which will deliver positive results above zero, but which do not impair driver behavior. So somebody going to church on a Sunday who has communion wine may be stopped and will be tested, and they will show a reading above zero. And according to this legislation, they will be above that limit, and therefore they will be in trouble. Now, that driver is clearly not going to be impaired, and the proposal does not consider that. The proposal does not consider current traffic law enforcement, blood testing and prosecution infrastructure, which is severely strained and struggling to cope. And for us, this is a key point in our presentation. A decrease in alcohol levels will mean that there will be an increase in arrests, which are already around the 90,000 mark annually. And if you do that, you are going to add massively to this problem. You're going to add massively to the infrastructure that is there, and it's going to add massive strain to the system that is already struggling to cope. And we believe it will add all of that strain at no real value. The legislation alone will not solve the problem of drunk driving in South Africa. Effective policing is needed, and I think that that is something that is filtering through in many of the studies that we've seen, not only from South Africa, but internationally. And again, that goes back to what the WHO said. There is no fear of being caught, as I've mentioned before. There are too few traffic law enforcers on South African roads. The capacity of the traffic law enforcement value chain is strained, and that's where we believe the focus should be. There needs to be capacity building of traffic law enforcers. There needs to be improved prosecutions. There needs to be improvement in the sampling of drunk drivers. That's where the focus must be. Legislation to zero is, in our view, going to be ineffective. Technology must be better employed than it is at the moment, and severe punitive measures for offenders need to be introduced. The auto legislation gives offenders too much leeway, and I'm talking about drunk driving offenders who have chance upon chance upon chance before their vehicle licenses or their driving licenses are eventually cancelled. And this is something that is also very important to us. Education and public awareness campaigns need to be ramped up and consistent to curb what we deem is antisocial behavior of drunk driving, not only for motorists, but for pedestrians, for people who are commuters, for people who are riding motorbikes, for people who are on cycles. This is quite clear. I'm wrapping up in a minute, Chairman. We believe you cannot solve a problem with a problem, and that's exactly what this legislation will do. And you cannot legislate yourself out of a problem that requires boots on the ground. Again, that's what we believe this legislation is going to do. And education and public awareness campaigns are needed to root out the problem of drunk driving. Finally, we propose a minimum BAC of 0.2% across the board, improve traffic law enforcement capacity building, that's training, increased numbers of traffic law enforcement officers, improved use of technology, and improved management of alcohol cases by laboratories and courts. And I hope I didn't run through that too quickly, but that essentially is our presentation. And there are some of the references. And as I said earlier, I will provide all of this information through this slide. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Mr. Leighton Beard, for the presentation. Let's take Honorable Ansinga and Honorable McDonald and Honorable Mabena. Those are the three honorable members who wishes to talk to you. Please be ready for them. Let's forge ahead, Honorable Unsinger.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you, Mr. Beard from AA, for taking time to scrutinize the proposed legislation in its current form and to give us your inputs. Most importantly, to also give us suggestions of the framework which through this legislation is introduced for intended framework change and what should be reconsidered and retained. And I'm specifically referring to Section 11, Sub 1. Your remark about the K53 being outdated is something which I found interesting. And I would ask you for your insights as to what the correct approach would be, because you are criticizing the section in this bill that speaks to training and instructors, driving school instructors, with a suggestion that before K53 isn't addressed, it is senseless then to have the approach which you suggest in this bill. How different would you suggest it should be done? I think your remark there was grading of instructors was premature. So if you could expand on that, it would help us. Your insight, supported by evidence of international and local research around the limited impact which a reduction on minimum alcohol levels have in relation to the number of crashes is insightful. And in a way, in just leaving it as is, I'm of the opinion that nothing will happen. And we certainly need to address this. So could you please give us your insight on how this best should be approached and how this could be included in the current National Road Traffic Amendment Bill so as to address it and not land with a situation where we maintain the status quo and also a trend of increased crashes. A general question to you, Mr. Beard. What, in your opinion, should also be included and considered as content and with this bill and in expanding the scope of this bill? Are we covering everything, or are there, in your opinion, areas that should be added to the scope and therefore included in this amendment exercise? Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you, Mr. Beard.
Thank you, Honorable Unsinger. Let's get Honorable McDonald.
Thank you, Chairperson. I want to thank the presenter for the presentation. It was very well thought of. Chairperson, I don't really have many questions. I agree on most of the things that the presenter has presented. I strongly agree on the 0.02% alcohol across the board. I also think that we have, on many of the issues on South African roads, it's not legislative issues, it is enforcement. We don't enforce the laws. I was thinking now that drunken driving in this country, we don't name and shame. You know, in the 80s, Chairperson, there was an ad on the television that they used to show where people that are not wearing seatbelts are pumpkins, and the pumpkin hits the windscreen and it goes through. It was a very effective way of showing to people the consequences of not wearing a seatbelt. Now, those are one of the things that we need to address, Chairperson. We are talking about alcohol limits. We're talking about other things, but we don't even enforce a small thing like wearing a seatbelt. Chairperson, I drive the roads every day of my life, and every day, more than 40% of the people driving their vehicles do not wear the seatbelts, Chairperson. And those are the reasons why people die in accidents. If you look in Mozambique, where they've got a very loose alcohol and driving legislation. I mean, they sell alcohol at every petrol station. But they have the least amount of drunken driving because they enforce their laws. I was just thinking now that at night, you know, we have a huge problem in South Africa where people, where pedestrians get killed because of the way that the spatial development of this country in apartheid times. But I mean, even in Mozambique, when people walk at night, they use their cell phone lights to walk to make them more visible. We need campaigns like that, Chairperson, where we can make the roads safer for all the people. And as much as we need legislation, we need enforcement, and we need to have an active campaign where people of South Africa are educated on the dangers of drunken driving, the dangers of not wearing seatbelts, and the dangers of walking at night, intoxicated and not intoxicated. Chairperson, I thank you very much.
Thank you, Honorable McDonald. Masithokoze Mhlonishwa, ubaba uMaphena.
Sithokoze Sihlalo, sithokoze khulu kubaba uBeard. Look, just about two comments. I think I'm only going to comment on the issue of the micro dots technology, and also the fact that the minister has just singled out that security feature in terms of regulation, whereas there is alongside other features which perhaps can be regulated, and how that would have negative consequences on private companies which are operating at that space, and how that they can actually unilaterally put them out of business. And looking at the current economic state and situation of our country, I do believe that the AA's proposal in this instance is correct. Yes, the micro dot technology does provide some sort of security on vehicles, but it's not the only security. And also, given the fact that the micro dot technology currently, it is the only type of enhanced security measures which will be singled out and regulated by the department, it doesn't make any sense whatsoever, because it will almost allowing the department to decide on a company's future, and that can affect potentially a number of employees, revenue, and in terms of the existence of that company. And I think I would definitely agree with AA on that and your view on that, Mr. Piet. Secondly, the appointment of Inspectorate of Driving Licensing Testing Centers, which removes the Shareholders Committee, which is particularly on Section 11. Definitely agree with you. I think the motivation from the department is insufficient in this instance. Look, for instance, the Department of Transport just 3 days ago, they announced on national TV that they are going to be appointing 80 MK vets to be coordinators on the platforms for PRASA. And one, that thing was not advertised. And the only thing which the department's motivation there is that those people are former MK vets. And what this then does is, if you remove the Shareholders Committee from the appointment of the Inspectorate of Driving Licensing Testing Centers, then this gives the minister, through Section 11, full control of that process. Then that means next week we can wake up to a situation where the minister will come in and make an announcement and say, no, I'm going to be appointing 100 former MK vets to be licensing inspectorate a member. So I think on that issue, Mr. Piet, fully agree and support the AA's proposal there. The Shareholders Committee must, that section and the deletion of that section must be reviewed, and I would implore the committee that it will be giving the minister unilateral power, and of which, in terms of the spirit of holding the executive to account, will not work in our favor at all. And I think in terms of the grading of instructors, and the question of the usefulness of the current K53 legislation. Look, I think on that as well, I would also, the grading, I would say it is necessary. I don't think it is premature to be done at this point in time. But I think perhaps more information on that from the department needs to be provided for us in order for us to make a considerable proposal on this issue, and also perhaps if we agree or we don't agree with them on those issues. And then moving on to what you had made, Mr. Yates, in terms of the...
As you round up?
Yes, I'm rounding up, Chairperson. In terms of the blood alcohol concentration being taken down to 0.00%. Look, I'm not a religious person myself, but I think if you remove that issue from someone going to church, doing a Holy Communion, and then they get wine. Look, I'm not a religious person. I'm a very traditional person. But as well, we have ceremonies when we go to Pasha, you know, to speak to the ancestors. When you get there, you're also given a calabash of umtomboti, traditional beer. You are not necessarily drinking to get drunk, but if you consume too much on that, you will get drunk. But for the purposes of the ceremony, if I take one or two sips of that, and then as we're driving away, and then I'm stopped by the traffic officers on the road, and they say, yes, sakbamba, poof,
your PAC is above 0.00%, and you find that I am actually capable of driving outside of of other issues. So I think on that, definitely, the reduction of blood alcohol concentration on drivers being reduced to 0.00% will not aid us in terms of reducing and curbing road fatality, but what we need to do, concentrate on more law enforcement and also cap and make sure that there's no corruption within that space. So, Chairperson, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Honorable Member. Ubaba Umapena. Mr. Layton, you have 5 minutes on the dot, and it's not my mistake.
No, thank you, Mr. Chair, and you were absolutely correct. I think my concession previously has certainly come to bite me. But I'm very happy that the concession I made was for Mr. Mabena, because it seems that he certainly has agreed with many of my points. So it may have been a concession well worth it. I think just in terms of what Mr. McDonald said, and thank you for your feedback, sir. You talk of shock advertising as a means of dealing with drunken driving and the naming of shaming. I think our point of view would be that education is something that is required even from a young age. We have long advocated for education at primary school level to teach children what road traffic signs are, and that evolves over a period of time to older children about how to ride a bicycle and how to ride a motorbike, and then eventually what the controls of a vehicle are and what the dangers are that you will face, not only as a driver, but as a passenger and as a pedestrian or somebody on a cycle. So we believe that the introduction of an intensive nationwide education program is absolutely critical. And I think that touches on the last question that Mr. Hunsinger had about what we would have liked to have seen in the bill. And it would have been some reference to the need for this education to be pervasive throughout schooling, and that it needs to form part of the curriculum, something within life orientation maybe, where children from a young age are exposed to traffic laws, traffic signs, road safety messaging. And because you can have a campaign that runs when somebody's, older, somebody like me who is way past 20, the behavior is already there. People who are drinking and driving, the legislation is not going to prevent that. People are going to do it because, as I mentioned previously, there is no fear of being caught. So for us, it's about getting people early and getting them when they are children and informing them along that road. So in answer to your question, Mr. Hunsinger, perhaps that is something that we felt would have been necessary. We need some sort of legislation which compels the education of children in schools about road safety education. You asked about the K53 test. It was introduced in South Africa in 1996. Since then, vehicle technology has progressed at an enormous pace. New technologies are coming in all the time. Vehicles have changed. The volume of vehicles on our roads have changed. People's perception of driving has changed a lot. That test needs to keep pace with that. It hasn't. And our point is that you are going to be teaching instructors to teach to pass the K53, when in fact what is happening is we are creating a situation in South Africa where we have very many millions of people who are licensed drivers, but very few of those millions are capable drivers. And for us, the testing needs to ensure that we have capable drivers. If that means we have a grading for when you can drive on an highway, you need certain hours behind your vehicle before you're allowed to drive on certain roads, then that is something that needs to be considered. But the fact that the K53 is outdated and hasn't been updated, as the driving instructing or the driver testing in other countries is updated on a regular basis, that is something that we would like to see in South Africa. At the end of the day, our focus must be on reducing deaths in South Africa on our roads, and it must be about creating safer drivers. I trust that answers your question, Mr. Hunsinger.
you are left with a minute, sir.
I think I am done. I think unless there's anything else, I'm happy with that.
No, thank you very much, Ms. Leighton. As we move forward, we will take for sure into consideration your presentation as we sit as a committee to shape the legislation. We want to thank you very much for your inputs in this regard, and we wish to liberate you from this committee for now. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Chair. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much. With that note, we are going to call upon Mr. Maurice Smithers. He is representing SAAPA. Mr. Maurice.
Morning, Chair. Thank you very much. Morning to everybody else who's on this Zoom session. And thank you very much for the opportunity of talking about the issue. I'm now going to share my screen. Can everybody see the screen now?
Yes, sir. You have shared your screen now. We can see.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Okay, thanks very much. So I'm from the Southern African Alcohol Policy Alliance. The Southern African Policy Alliance, we are an NGO registered with DSD and the CIPC. We are a public health-driven advocacy group for an alcohol-safe South Africa. And I've underlined public health-driven and alcohol-safe just to make clear from the outset that we are not a religious organization. We're not driven by any kind of moral persuasion. And we are also not abolitionists. We are not calling for an end to alcohol in the country. What we are arguing for is a society in which the consumption, the sale and consumption of alcohol is safe for everyone, drinkers and non-drinkers alike. We work a lot with public health researchers like the SAMRC, who you're going to be hearing from after me. We also work with other civil society partners in a range of sectors who are alliance partners, and these are some of them. As you can see, the Cancer Association, Children's Institute, Child Safe, Gun Free South Africa, National Council Against Smoking, People's Health Movement, Save the Children, and so on. And the point about these organizations is that they are not directly dealing with alcohol issues, but their work in their sector is directly impacted upon by the challenges we have around alcohol in South Africa. So the summary of our written submission was that we support the reduction of the BAC and the BARAC to zero for general and professional drivers. And this is because of the unacceptably high road traffic incident rate in South Africa, 58% of road deaths related to alcohol use, according to the World Health Organization in 2018. Many victims are passengers, including children and pedestrians, as has been mentioned earlier on. And we believe that roads should be safe for all. That's the basic principle that should be applied when making these decisions. Furthermore, the message we believe should be that drinking and driving don't mix at all. And as I think other people have said, clearly is that it must be accompanied by other measures. You're not going to solve, we accept that you're not going to solve the alcohol-related problems in the country simply by reducing the BAC to zero. I'll talk more about that as we go along. Why is action necessary? Well, according to the RTMC document, driving under influence of alcohol is one of the biggest threats to road safety in the country, since it slows human reaction time, distorts the driver's vision. And as estimated, according to Matsopoulos and others in 2014, an estimated 24% of SA driver deaths and non-fatal injuries would be prevented if drivers were not driving under the influence of alcohol. the estimated proportion of alcohol-related traffic incidents is 27%, and the health and damage costs attributable to alcohol-related RTIs is about is 18.25 billion rand. Pedestrians are we talked about pedestrians early on. They're more than three times likely to die in a crash where the driver of the vehicle that struck them was intoxicated. And in a report by Genesis Analytics for NEDLAC on the Liquor Amendment Bill, a different bill, they estimated that 185 lives would be saved a year due to a 3% reduction in alcohol-related road traffic fatalities, not because of BAC reductions, but because of other measures that would be included in that bill. Our fundamental position is that use of alcohol when driving actually ruins lives. Families are thrown into poverty. Growth and development is stunted. There's an unnecessary and unavoidable burden on the health system, and we've all seen that under COVID-19, where trauma units didn't have the spate of trauma incidents coming in as a result partly of drinking and driving, because people were not drinking or they were under curfew, and the economy as a whole is affected. Some findings in global research is that lowering the rate does indeed work if it is properly sustained, communicated, and enforced. And there are a number of cases that have shown that, including the World Health Organization, which in fact does argue for that says that the reduction should be at least, or the rate should be at least as low as 0.05. They don't say that it shouldn't be lower than that, but they say it shouldn't be higher than that. It is true that some countries have a bigger problem than others for a variety of reasons, including socioeconomic conditions, also the length of time that they've taken to address the issue of drinking and driving. Some countries have been doing it for much longer, and therefore the culture of those countries has changed. There is actually no safe number of drinks because different people react differently to alcohol. So even one drink can affect someone's ability to drive. Our fundamental premise is that it must become socially unacceptable to drink and drive. And it mustn't just be a legal thing, but also must be socially unacceptable in the same way that smoking in public places is currently socially unacceptable as a result of the legislation we have in the country. And finally, it is possible to change the culture of drinking over time. For example, Russia, where a variety of measures led to a 43% reduction in consumption over 20 years. Now, a 43% reduction in alcohol consumption is obviously going to have a spin-off effect in a whole range of sectors, including the incidence of drinking and driving. So the general consensus around the world is that taking an alcohol drink does impair driving ability and influences a driver's attitude, judgment, vigilance, perception, reaction, and controlling of the motor vehicle. One study points out that when you're driving, you have to multitask, and alcohol actually reduces your ability to multitask, and that's putting yourself and others at risk. Alcohol use contributes to other driving risk factors, including speeding, disregarding traffic lights and signs, overtaking, fatigue, falling asleep, and cell phone distraction. In other words, if you're drunk, you're more likely to do some of those things than if you were not drunk. The impact of one or two drinks on the drinker, i.e. a BAC between 0.002 and 0.005, increase in heart and breathing rates, decrease in various central brain functions, inconsistency in performing tasks, impaired judgment, loss of inhibition, mild sense of elation, and so on. I just want to talk quickly about the relationship of alcohol, of the standard units to BAC, because I'm not sure that people in the country understand these things. Not all drinks are the same. So like a glass of beer is not the same as a glass of whiskey, for example. So there's a system of determining how many standard units of alcohol, i.e. pure alcohol, are in each drink. For some reason, the standard unit rate varies from country to country. In South Africa, it's considered to be 15 milliliters. Australia, it's 12. The UK, it's 10. But we will go with 15 for South Africa. It's also possible to measure how many units are in each kind of drink using the volume of the beverage and its strengths. So the formula is volume times strength equals divided by 1,500 for South Africa equals the number of standard units in a drink. And a standard unit in South Africa of alcohol will increase BAC by 0.0225. So if you take a 340 ml beer of 4%, it's quite a low rating. That's 340 times 4 divided by 1,500 gives you 0.9 standard units. You multiply that point by 0.0225 to get your BAC, how much that beer will increase your BAC. That takes you to the 0.02 level. So in other words, a single beer will take you up to 0.02. A 750 ml, 5.5 beer, a quart is of a Carling Black Label, for example, is 5.5%. That is 2.75 standard units. That means that somebody who drinks a quart of beer, and many people do, and then drives, will be driving with 0.062 BAC. That's three times, that's over the current limit of 0.05. It would be three times a 0.02 limit, and of course it's six times what it should be if it was zero. A 170 ml glass of wine, that's a modest glass of wine at 13%, 1.52 standard units, 0.034 BAC, and a 50 ml, that's two tots, a double of spirits, is 1.44 standard units, and that gives you a 0.032 BAC. So in a diagram, this would show you that if you had, for example, a 0.02 limit, which some people are proposing, one can of beer will take you there. A Zamalek, a quart, will take you to 0.062. A glass of wine will take you to 0.034, and double whiskey to 0.032. So that takes you over the limit with each of those drinks. Now, these are indicative, not definitive, and I'll explain why, because there are other factors that can affect BAC, e.g. one drink may give women a higher BAC than men. Body mass is a factor and so on. Not everyone responds in the same way. Some people can get affected more than others, but everyone is likely to be affected. The alcohol content does wear off over time, so it does depend on the time lapse between when the drink or drinks were or was consumed and when the person gets into the vehicle. Calculations and effects are definitely scientific. They're not guesswork, but they are not precise, creating uncertainty. A zero rate allows for greater certainty. There's no argument. If you have a zero rate, then there's no argument about having drunk too much or too little. Brazil is a very interesting case study, which points to some of the challenges that one faces around these issues, including some of the issues raised by the AA representative. Brazil introduced a zero rate in 2008 and strengthened the law in 2012. There was an immediate drop in drink driving, 45% less positive breathalyzer tests. But after a while, it began to increase again, not because the law itself failed, but because, and these issues have been alluded to, Brazil has very few limits on where, when, and how people can sell and consume alcohol, unlike South Africa. The other thing is there wasn't sustained enforcement. That issue has been raised. There's also an interesting thing in Brazil where a citizen can refuse to submit to a blood test. We don't have that situation here, but it is a problem factor there. Communication around the zero rate was very poor. So in research studies, many people claim not to know about it. Because of these factors, many people, especially young people, don't expect to get caught. And if they do, they don't expect to be found guilty. Some challenges in South Africa. We also have a problem with enforcement and corruption and an overall culture of problem drinking. As some people say, if you can't enforce 0.05, how can you enforce zero? Which is a commonly expressed concern. I mean, we think you can, but nevertheless, the sentiment is understood and acknowledged. We do have a good alcohol policy in the country, but we don't yet have other effective measures in place to support efforts to reduce drinking and driving. The Liquor Amendment Bill from the DTRC is pending, but it needs to come in place. And that will introduce other legislation like limiting advertising, like changing operating hours of liquor outlets, like maybe reducing the number of liquor outlets. And all of those things will contribute to the overall project of reducing alcohol harm and will contribute as well to reducing the number of people that get on the road and drink. Communication around legislation is generally very poor and not sustained. For many people, it is socially acceptable to drink and drive. And that for us is a very, very serious issue. The fact that it is, in some people's views, socially acceptable to drink and drive. And notes on novice drivers. In many countries where the limit is above zero, there is a specific zero rating for novice drivers. A novice driver is a learner driver of any age, somebody who's starting to learn to drive at 18 or somebody who's learning to drive at the age of 25 or 30. In both instances, they need to become used to being on the road. Novice drivers in particular, young, are targeted because learning to drive often coincides with being able to drink for the first time. So novice drivers are normally subject to a zero rate for a period of 3 years. This is only going to be relevant, and we're asking the Portfolio Committee to consider this, because it hasn't been included. This is only relevant if the decision is taken finally to not impose a zero rating, but a rating of 0.02 instead, as was originally proposed in the 2012 bill. So if a 0.02 rating is adopted, we believe that there should be a special clause talking about novice drivers, and that should be a zero rating. So our approach generally is that the message really in society should be unequivocally that drinking and driving don't mix and is socially unacceptable. We also believe that the regulatory environment, like the smoking legislation, must empower citizens generally to influence and sanction people who drink and drive. So we must be able to police each other as well as rely on the authorities to police us when it comes to the issue of drinking and driving. We accept that there are potential difficulties in imposing a zero rate because of the presence of alcohol in medicine and other products that might lead to a false positive reading, but the possibility of such unintended consequences is not in itself a reason to change the recommendations in the bill. Mitigating steps can be taken to deal with that, including advice to drivers, proper training of traffic officials so that they don't arrest people unnecessarily, but also a sliding scale for dealing with infringements. And this is also adopted in other countries like Brazil. So for example, if somebody has a reading of 0 to 0.02, they can get a warning. And that's for all drivers, general and professional drivers and novice drivers. So that kind of excludes the possibility of somebody having taken a medicine with alcohol in it. The second thing is if you go between 0.02 and 0.05, there would be a fine for general drivers, a point on their license perhaps, but a criminal charge for professional drivers and suspension of license. Because obviously we have to be much harsher with professional drivers, especially those who are traveling with passengers and those who are driving very, very large vehicles. And obviously novice drivers would be affected here too. And then finally, above 0.05, a criminal charge for all and suspension of license. So we're saying that there is no need to criminalize every single infringement. There are steps that can be taken to build a culture of not drinking by having different ways of responding. So our conclusion is that we should adopt the clause on BAC and BRAC levels, that mitigating steps should be introduced to avoid the unjust implementation of the clause. In a quote from Campos et al. 2012, other measures for a public policy related to alcohol should be considered based on scientific evidence, consistency of action, clear goals, community support, and greater reliability in the laws. So we think this is very critical, and therefore we would urge the Portfolio Committee on Transport to call for additional measures by other departments and for enforcement agencies to improve their performance and to eliminate corruption, because otherwise your efforts as the Department of Transport efforts and the efforts of the Portfolio Committee are going to be compromised if there isn't an overall national campaign to address these issues in a holistic way. And finally, just to reinforce the other point, that the legislative environment must make it possible for societal control as well. For example, creating a climate in which passengers can refuse to get into a car being driven by someone who has been drinking or can stop a driver from drinking. For example, this even includes children whose lives are at risk if their parents have been drinking, challenging their parents or spouses challenging each other. We need a similar environment to that which controls smoking in public places, in cars, at home, etc. In that way, we will build a national culture around the issue of drinking and driving, in fact, around the consumption of alcohol in general, and we will then move closer to having an alcohol-safe society. So that's our input so far. We can make available the references to the research that we have quoted, and we are very interested to hear the comments and questions that the committee might have. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Maurice Smithers, for the detailed inputs. Members, I'm sure we'll remember that ours is to be impartial. We are not going to agree or disagree, but we are being enhanced so that as we have our own space and time, we can then take these views into consideration when we legislate. Let me get the first member, Honorable Ann Singer, followed by Honorable McDonald.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you, Mr. Morris Smithers, from your organization, SAAPA, for your submission, and thank you for taking time to present a very substantial and content full of information, also including research and references. It definitely then guides us in terms of gaining insight. In particularly, I found your infringement sliding scale on the alcohol use very interesting. And I would want to just get some further ideas from you around basically a golden thread that ran throughout your presentation and submission, where you referenced supporting efforts, you reference policing each other, and you reference mitigating steps. Can you, and also additional measures by other departments, can you expand on these and give us an idea of, alternatively to just going for a zero rate, how additional steps can be taken which one could then in a way control better in order to get a safer road? Because I fully agree with several of your slogans that you use, that road should be a safe place for all, and that zero rate allows for greater certainty. So can you expand on those supporting efforts, policing each other and mitigating steps? Lastly, Chairperson, I'm not familiar with the organization which Mr. Smithers represents. If he can also just give us an indication of the membership, how many members the organization then represent. Thank you, Chairperson, and thanks again, Mr. Smithers.
Thank you, Honorable Hunsinger. Honorable McDonald.
Thank you, Chairperson. I would also like to thank the presenter for his presentation. I was a bit confused when I saw the SAAPA, and I thought it was the South African Airways Pilots Association, and I was a bit confused. But on a lighter note, Chairperson, I just want to, on the presentation, this, we all agree, all of us sitting here, that alcohol is definitely a contributing factor to accidents. But as I stated categorically before, there are many situations where alcohol is inadvertently consumed. I was just looking at the BMC Infectious Diseases paper. It was this paper was actually published in 2007, long before we had coronaviruses around. And your blood alcohol level for a theater nurse due to absorption through the skin would rise to about 15 milligrams per liter in 30 minutes due to all these sanitizing and alcohol swabs that they are using. So we must be very careful when we institute this type of limit that we do not infringe on the rights of innocent, law-abiding citizens just doing their work, Jefferson. So as much as I agree with everything what the presenter said, I also want to just point out that he stated that Brazil has got a 0% alcohol limit. My research states that Brazil has got a zero tolerance on BAC infringements, and that the limit is 0.02 and not a stated 0%. Those are my submissions, Jefferson. I thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable McDonald. Mr. Smithers.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for the two inputs. Mr. Hansinger's question about policing each other. I think that the point we are trying to make there is that in a society, in a well-run society, where people, and one can go back to some of the proposals that were made in the previous presentation when Mr. Beard was speaking about having education around issues right from a very young age, that in a well-run society and in a society where you build a sense of social responsibility, I suppose you could say, then people do police each other. People actually, and part of the reason people do that is because it's in their interests to do that. And whether that's around drinking and driving or smoking or littering or any of the other things that happen in society, it's in everyone's interests ultimately for those things to be adhered to. The problem that we have in our society is that alcohol has been so normalized and so glamorized in society that it's very difficult for someone to exercise, and not necessarily a non-drinker, it can even be a drinker, but to exercise some kind of peer group sanction over somebody else around drinking. I remember back in the day when smoking wasn't regulated in the way that it is now. If you were a non-smoker and you were in a room or in a space with a smoker, it was very, very difficult to intervene and say to that person, please don't smoke, because somehow you were seen to be infringing on the rights of that person to smoke. The legislation that's been introduced has actually shifted that balance of power. And I think given the fact that alcohol in a range of ways, not just with drinking and driving, but in every respect, alcohol is a threat to public health. It's a threat to safety if it is misused. Therefore, people should have the right to be able to exercise their right to control others around them when it comes to the way in which alcohol is both sold and consumed. And there are any number of people who live in precarious communities in our country who can attest to that, because they live in conditions where alcohol is consumed in a very dangerous way around them, and there's very little they can do about it. So that's the essence of what we're talking about. Now, that requires a national strategy. That requires national commitment from everyone across society to that. But it starts with an understanding within society that alcohol is not actually a normal part of society, that alcohol is a drug, like any other drug, and it should be treated with great, great caution. The problem with alcohol is that people started using alcohol more than 12,000 years ago when there was no understanding of what alcohol was. There was no understanding of what it was in alcohol that actually made you drunk, that had the impact that it had. All of that information has only been really understood over the past 150 years. But in that 12,000 years, alcohol has become embedded in society. And so for a lot of people, it's very difficult to question alcohol in society. And that's really what we are suggesting should change. Again, not to say that you ban alcohol, but that you understand the extent to which it is actually a dangerous drug and therefore needs to be managed much better in the interest of everybody. The additional measures we are talking about, well, I can refer to the World Health Organization. The World Health Organization has what they call three best buys. And those best buys are that you limit or you ban alcohol advertising, because alcohol advertising actually is what normalizes and glamorizes alcohol and encourages people to drink alcohol. The second thing is reducing availability. And you do that in a number of ways. And some of those ways, all of these, by the way, are contained in South Africa's alcohol policy of 2016, which has not been implemented. But it was adopted by cabinet in 2016. So all of these are there, including, so with availability, it's increasing the age of drinking to 21, and that is proposed in the Liquor Amendment Bill of 2016, which DTRC is working on. It's through changing the operating hours of alcohol outlets. Some places in South Africa, people basically operate 24 hours. Some go to 2 o'clock, 4 o'clock in the morning. So that's another way of reducing availability, is having restricted operating hours. That's also contained in the policy and in the Liquor Amendment Bill. And then there's the number of liquor outlets. That one can have a quota on how many liquor outlets you have in a particular neighborhood. This is done in many other countries in the world to great effect, because it means that you actually reduce the availability of alcohol in that way. There's other ways you can do that too with availability. And the third way is you increase the price of alcohol. That is that you increase that in two particular ways. One is increased excise tax, which was included in the budget this year, although not enough, and also minimum unit pricing, where you actually don't allow the sale of alcohol below a certain price per alcohol content. And that's been adopted in a number of countries, including Russia, Scotland, and so on. Because by doing that, you reduce consumption, because people cannot afford to drink as much as they would otherwise. And all of these together should actually contribute to a change in the way in which alcohol is consumed in the country. And that would then support any efforts to reduce drinking and driving. Because obviously, if people are drinking less and they are drinking more safely and they're drinking in a more conscious way, that's going to impact on their inclination to drink and drive. SAPA SA is, as I said, it's an alliance organization. We have 17 alliance partners. So to actually tell you how many members we have, I would have to do a breakdown of the members of all the organizations that are alliance partners to us. And I unfortunately can't do that. I think I should have to do that, because I'm sure this question will come up again. But it would be a large number of organizations, a large number of people, and this is people right across the country working in local communities, in neighborhoods, and people who are working in national projects across the country, things like Sonke Gender Justice, the Teddy Bear Foundation, South African Cancer Association. So all of these, and we are increasing the number of alliance partners all the time, because we believe that we should build a kind of social movement around this issue in order to create a new climate and culture in the country. To Mr. McDonald's question, yes, I have seen that SAPA is also the name of the South African Airline Pilots Association. And I was thinking about pilots this morning and how bizarre it is that some people actually drink before they fly airplanes. If we think that drinking and driving is a problem, imagine somebody having a drink before they actually fly an airplane, and people do. So but the other thing I wanted to mention to Mr. McDonald is we don't talk about accidents, vehicle accidents or car accidents, because we believe that if you drink and drive, it's not an accident that you have a car crash. You actually are creating the conditions where it can happen. So therefore, alcohol-related traffic incidents aren't accidents. They are traffic-related, alcohol-related traffic incidents or crashes. Look, the inadvertent consumption issue is clearly one that needs to be looked into, and scientists can probably talk more about that than we can. And I think Professor Parry will probably talk to that issue when he does his presentation. I recall that a couple of years ago, somebody even said that if you eat a hot cross bun at Easter, that for about half an hour after that, your alcohol level will be increased. But we believe that science that we have today, technology we have today, and proper training of law enforcement officers will actually create conditions where you can mitigate the problems around that. And we're not saying it will be easy, and we're not saying it will be immediate. It will develop over time, but we don't believe that that's a reason to not consider having the zero rating. And finally, on the issue of Brazil, it is true that sometimes there is a little bit of confusion about how the issue of Brazil is stated, because there are some reports and some research that says a zero rating. Some say a 0.01 rating, and some say that it is zero tolerance, as you said. I haven't read anywhere that it's 0.02. But I think the principle basically is the zero tolerance issue, and then having, as they've got in Brazil, a mechanism for ensuring that he has a very low level of alcohol in their bloodstream, that will not be treated as a criminal offense. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Morris Smithers, for the insight on this issue. We will definitely consider your inputs as we sit down as a committee doing other work that will ensure that we end up with an act that represents the view of the people of South Africa, including the views of those who came to us and presented. We want to thank you for your preparedness for this meeting. We wish you a healthy and a good year ahead, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you to everybody else. We hope we look forward with interest to see what the outcome is. But I do want to stress that I would really like to encourage the Transport Portfolio Committee to engage with their colleagues in other portfolio committees to push for additional measures. For example, like I said, through DTIC or social development or health, to ensure that the work that you do is supported by other measures that holistically and globally contribute towards a better and safer alcohol environment in the country. So thank you very much.
Thank you. You are released there. Thank you. Now we're going to get a submission by Professor Parry, who is representing something called ATODRU, Alcohol, Tobacco and Other Drug Research Unit. Professor, are you with us?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me, Mr. Chair?
I can not only hear you, but I can also see you, Professor.
Excellent, excellent. That's great. Thank you very much. I'm from the South African Medical Research Council. So it's the Alcohol, Tobacco and Other Drug Research Unit, as you said. Let me put my slideshow on and see if I can share that quickly. Share screen, okay.
You have?
Yeah,
I'm sorry. Professor on the headache.
Yeah, sorry, I'm just getting the screen here to share. Just trying to get the right screen to share. Now it's showing, okay, that one. Okay, can you, you should see it shortly.
Shortly, I'm waiting, I can't see.
Okay, I did say I wanted to share the screen, let's try again. Share. Let's see. Now, can you see that?
Crystal clear, Professor. I can
Brilliant.
Now see screen and you, and please forge ahead.
Okay, thank you very much. I only have 12 slides. Now I have 11. I'm going to give a brief background to drinking in South Africa, then a slide on the effects of alcohol on drivers and collateral damage, some of which has been said before. And then the heart of my presentation is to talk about policy options, support for reducing blood alcohol concentration levels and evidence for effectiveness, and then finally end with something on monitoring and evaluation, which I believe is also crucial and not as much has been said. As we know, Section 65 of the Principal Act 93 of 1996 has been it's proposed that it's amended to basically say no person may be on a public road or drive a vehicle or occupy the driver's seat of a vehicle where the engine is running while there is any concentration of alcohol in their body. So let's just look at some of the data. If we go to the injury mortality survey of 2017, but before I do that, I wanted to say that according to the World Health Organization's report of 2018, the road traffic death rate in South Africa is just under 40 per 100,000 every year, and it's double the global rate. So we've heard a lot about that. We do have a problem. We can't just keep doing the same. We need to look for solutions. And some of them are around reducing the blood alcohol concentration maximum level for drivers. And as the previous speaker said, this can't be done in isolation. We really need a basket of interventions, but this is certainly a good place to start in the short term. So what the slide shows is the levels of alcohol in fatally injured drivers, pedestrians, and passengers. So if you look at the drivers, 44% of the drivers, this is South African data, had a zero blood alcohol concentration, but 54 had a positive concentration, and it's broken down by between those different levels there. And again, we've talked a bit about, there's been a bit of discussion around pedestrians as well, and passengers obviously also are fatally injured and are found to have high levels of blood alcohol. So that's just part of the context. Let's look at different parts of the world and see what legislation is. This is also from the Global Status Report on Alcohol and Health from the World Health Organization 2018. And the darker the shading means that there is less, a more permissive level of alcohol, maximum alcohol concentration. So there are some countries which have what's called zero tolerance. That's the lightest shading, like Greenland, for example, where there's no tolerance, Saudi Arabia, for any alcohol in the blood of drivers. And then you've got shadings in other areas. But 15 countries have a zero blood alcohol concentration for drivers, and 31 have a maximum concentration between 0.01 and 0.05. And in fact, 27% of countries have less than 0.05. There was discussion around Brazil. In fact, Brazil is 0.02. So the countries at the bottom there, Brazil, Norway, Sweden, Israel, Poland, China, Hungary, India, Japan, Russia, and Uruguay, and obviously there's a lot of people living in some of these countries. If you look at the global population, they live in countries where there is a maximum level of 0.02 or 0.03. So we're looking at BRICS countries, for example, Brazil, Russia, China, India, and so on. A lot of them have you know, our partners there have concentrations of maximum of 0.02 and 0.03. So what is the effect of alcohol on drivers and looking at collateral damage? This is we've heard something similar, but not quite presented like this. We know that alcohol affects a driver's vision, balance, and reaction time. And drivers with a blood alcohol concentration between 0.02 and 0.05, research has shown that they have a more than three times greater risk of dying in a vehicle crash as compared to persons with a zero BAC. So certainly it increases your risk of dying substantially, and the risk increases with the greater amounts of alcohol in your blood, with more than six times for a BAC between 0.05 and 0.08, and more than 11 times or more when you're above 0.08. And as Maurice Smithers said, younger drivers are particularly at risk of crashing, whatever their BAC level, because they're less experienced drivers and generally have a lower tolerance to alcohol. But there's a growing recognition around the harm to others from people's drinking. And unfortunately, drunk drivers don't just kill and injure themselves or damage their own property. They kill or injure other road users and damage others' property as well. Cars, traffic lights, buildings, walls, etc. And as taxpayers, we have to fork out millions of rands each year to pay for many drunk drivers and persons injured by them to be treated and rehabilitated and to mend public property. I'm sure you drive around and see lampposts that are knocked over and you see that on a Saturday or Sunday morning. And that's usually us as taxpayers who have to pay for that. So what are the policy options? I've been working in this area. I run a unit, the largest research unit looking at alcohol issues in the African continent. We are supported by a parliamentary grant through the Portfolio Committee on Health, and we answer to the Department of Health. The MRC supports the idea of having zero tolerance for any drinking and driving. And we also believe in separating out the two events, drinking and driving. To have a driving license is a privilege, and it shouldn't necessarily come with the right to be drinking at the same time. By having a zero limit, or I'll talk a bit more about that, a very low limit, we would do away with the need for drivers to have to calculate whether they are over the limit. And I personally consume alcohol. And, you know, when you're sitting in a venue and you're having three drinks, and it's 3 hours, you have to work out, well, am I over the limit? You know, and actually I've reached the point now where I take an Uber if I'm going to be drinking more than one drink, but probably have to do that when it's lowered further. So yeah, I've thought about this a lot, and I propose and MRC a maximum of 0.02 grams of absolute alcohol per 100 milliliters of blood. This allows for testing positive, and we've heard about that, because you've taken certain medications or you've had a chocolate with a little bit of alcohol in it, and it reduces false positives from small traces going back as far as 12 hours previously. So I think for me, there's a no-brainer. You can have it at zero, but I think we should have allowances and only really start prosecuting people if it's above 0.02. And even then, I believe we should have administrative fines between 0.02 and 0.05. This is something that Maurice picked up on that I've been putting on the table for probably 20 years. Between 0.02 and 0.05, administrative fine, as we do with speeding, with low levels of speeding, you pay a fine, you maybe get points on your demerit points if we have that system all around the country. We don't want to overburden the criminal justice system with people caught with one drink, and criminalize people for small amounts of alcohol in their system. That doesn't mean we don't take it seriously, but we should think of the burden to the criminal justice system. And then we should continue with criminal prosecution for BACs at or above 0.05. What do people think about this? And I was leading a study, the International Alcohol Control Study, which was funded by the Canadian government. We collected the data in 2015, It's a study done in, I think, about 12 countries around the world, and I headed up the South African component of that. We collected data in Tswane and Gauteng, and the findings, and I've got a copy of the front page of that paper there. We looked at policy support from people who drink for various policy implementation of various policy control measures. We found that 55% of these drinkers, and in fact, they were not moderate drinkers, 53% of them were, we actually found them to be engaging in binge drinking at least monthly. 55% of these drinkers from a representative household survey in Tswane supported or strongly supported lower allowable blood alcohol concentrations for drivers. A further 17% indicated that they were neutral on this issue. So that's 72% who really were not opposed to dropping the BAC below 0.05 in South Africa. And only 28% were opposed to lowering this. This slide here, I won't go into great detail, but this is all the policy measures that we looked at. For example, should we raise the purchasing age, the minimum purchasing age to 21, we found that 77% of the drinkers supported that. It was obviously less for those drinkers who are younger than 21. And then the other measures are there. But you can see for type 4 drink driving counter measures, 58% supported or strongly supported a lower BAC limit for drink driving, and 76% said we should have more random breath testing. I'll pick up on that later. I mean, that's certainly, I can't think of how many times in my whole life I've been stopped. I've never been asked to breathe into an apparatus. Whereas if you go to Australia, the average driver, I think, has a 50% chance of being breathalyzed in a given year. We really need to up our game here. We can't just look at changing legislation without looking at the other things, as other drivers have said. So moving right along, evidence for effectiveness, the WHO global strategy to reduce the harmful use of alcohol in 2010 cites strong evidence in support of a low BAC limit between 0.02 and 0.05, as does the World Health Organization's Safer Initiative that Maurice Smithers referred to, and the five areas under the Safer category are limited there around drink driving, around controls on marketing, raising prices, and so on. So we turned to some data from three countries. In Brazil, a new traffic law that was in 2008 led to reductions in traffic injury and fatalities in the state and in the whole country and in the capital of São Paulo, between 7% in the state, in the country, and 16% in that capital region. And the difference there was due to enforcement. So enforcement is crucial. In Sweden, implementation of a 0.02 BAC law in 1990 reduced fatal crashes by 6%. This is all important. We're not going to have a magic bullet reducing all crashes, but 6% is a substantial reduction. We saw 7% in Brazil and in the country. In Japan, changing the BAC level to 0.03 in 2002, plus increasing penalties, had an effect. The rate of alcohol-related traffic fatalities per billion kilometers driven decreased by 38% in the post-law period. So we need other related strategies here, and I'm referring to the on the right to an umbrella review of systematic reviews of alcohol control interventions that was conducted by Dr. Nandi Siegfried and myself. It was published in 2019, looking at evidence for what works when we're trying to control alcohol at a population. We excluded school-based interventions. In this umbrella review of systematic reviews, so there are hundreds of studies, thousands of participants included in the analysis, we found that reducing BAC limits alone is unlikely to be successful if not combined with other interventions, such as increasing police patrols, mandating ignition locks to be installed in the vehicles of persons convicted of alcohol-impaired driving, which requires them to blow into a device which checks the driver's alcohol level before the vehicle will start. So I'm also calling for increasing random breath tests. This is different from sobriety checkpoints. Sobriety checkpoints are where you're stopped by the police and they decide who, if you look a little bit suspicious, your car's old, blah, blah, then they decide, okay, they're going to give this person a test rather than that person. Random testing is where it's completely random. It's done, there's a sort of a formula, and then you know, every third car or something like that is checked, regardless of who the driver is, what kind of car they're driving, how smart they are. So that's shown to be more effective. Certainly, we should consider mandatory testing of drivers at all crash sites where someone has been killed or seriously injured or serious damage to property. And obviously, if we do this, we're going to need to improve our testing capability. The bottom right-hand corner, you can see a car which drove into my wall in late February last year. And the police came because I live opposite a cabinet minister. So they called the police and the police were there. But the police officer refused to test the driver because he said, well, did I actually see, there were two people in the car. Did I see that person get out of the car? And they were afraid to test in case they'd swapped seats. And I thought that was the most ludicrous thing I've ever heard. So we should test everybody in that circumstance. And the person who says they're the driver, I certainly had a strong view. The person didn't deny who the driver was. We should be testing people when there's crashes. We should also consider legal liability for outlets or persons serving to obviously intoxicated persons, where they go on to cause a motor vehicle, and I think Maurice is correct, they're not accidents, a motor vehicle collision. And this is included in the what we call the STALL 2017 Department of Trade, Industry and Competition's Liquor Amendment Bill. It's 4 years since that bill was finished. It went out for public comment and nothing's been happening with it. So that bill does call for such legal liability. And the Western Cape Alcohol Harm Reductions White Paper, which also has not been enacted, fully enacted, those two pieces of legislation call for this. We also will need to improve public transport so that people who do want to have a drink don't aren't forced to drive there if they've got a car. It makes it easier for people to make correct choices. And in fact, many of us are starting to use Ubers now when we go out and we're going to have a drink or two. And certainly this bill, if we go down to 0.02 or zero, may also create new jobs in the e-hailing business. That could be a job creation strategy. No doubt industry will say it'll cost jobs, but it could also help create jobs, increase jobs, if people are now needing drivers. Finally, my last slide, monitoring and evaluation. I think this is also crucial. If you can't measure it, you can't know how well you're doing. And we have countless pieces of legislation which are there, but we don't have a good sense of how well they're working. So I think we need good, we may need to change the legislation to ensure, to ensure that there's a proper reporting of mandatory tests for alcohol at crash sites. That should be included in the legislation and it needs to be reported on. So we can see, okay, we're only testing 60%. We've got to up that next year. That should be reported on annually. We need reporting in Parliament on an annual basis on the percentage of people testing positive at roadside testing and the consequences. How many of those went on to have court cases and what were the outcomes of that, those court cases or court action or administrative action? You know, if you can't measure it, you can't really tell how well the legislation's doing. And finally, I've become very aware of this because of what's been going on with COVID-19. I really believe very strongly we need alcohol testing of transport, well, of all injury-related trauma at hospitals, and particularly transport-related injury appearing at hospitals. It could be done quite easily by, for example, an alcohol stick, which is like a test you have for blood glucose. It's a finger prick test on a little filament, and you put it into the machine there, which I've shown a picture, and it'll give you a BAC in 10% increments, for example, 0.01 to 0.02, 0.02 to 0.03, and so on. So monitoring and evaluation is crucial, and with that, I'm going to end. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Prof. Perry. We appreciate the presentation very much in terms of the effects of this 0%, 0.02%, and so forth and so on. And the novice drivers, as said by Morris Smithers, we are going to allow members to have a lot of questions for you because you are from the medical research and I'm sure partly because you are a professor. So that we, as we move forward, we know how to represent this presentation like we have done with other presentation. I have currently five hands for you. I'm going to start by Honorable Mabena, Honorable Stolle, Honorable Pete May, Honorable Lawrence McDonald, Honorable Manu, and Honorable Hunsinger, in that order, please.
Thokoza Sihlalo, and thank you for the opportunity. I think I would just like to check with the professor. Given the fact that you've given us the actual comparisons with other countries in terms of the blood alcohol content and how that has not really contributed in terms of the reduction of road fatalities, road fatalities and incidents, and therefore you're saying that the current blood alcohol content of 0.05% is also obvious, it doesn't lead to the reduction of fatalities. And also, you are also on the same breath saying that instead of having the blood alcohol concentration of 0.00%, you would then perhaps propose a 0.02% of blood alcohol concentration. And in essence, from the medical research side of things, the reduction of the blood alcohol concentration, there's no actual evidence which seeks to suggest that road fatalities has decreased over a period of time as a result of an action of legislation of reducing the blood alcohol concentration on the body for motorists and drivers. If that is the case, obviously that would mean then that the department should focus on other measures to make sure that in terms of ensuring that they reduce fatalities and all of those things, they strengthen other measures in terms of law enforcement and all those other things. But what perhaps I wanted to also just as the last deposit here is if we were to check in other static countries in terms of the blood alcohol concentration and in terms of the number of fatalities which is linked on that research, because I think the research, the comparison that you have given us, you've given us some countries which are far north. If maybe you can maybe give us in terms of the almost like a like for like comparison, but maybe much more with our neighbors, because that would then give us perhaps an indication. And I understand that this might it might be a bit of a tall ask, given the fact that maybe the availability of data from those countries might be a bit of a challenge and an uphill battle for one to receive or to access, or if it is regularly released and all of those things. So yeah, Chair, that's my deposit. Thank you.
Masibonga Mhlonishwa. Akunikeza umayikhi oseduze kwakho lapho ubaba uMhlonishwa uPick May.
Thank you, Chairperson. All I want to say, after listening to Mr. Beard, the previous speaker, and Professor Perry, and 02, but the main thing is to use alcohol responsibly. But what we need urgently is better law enforcement, and we need more traffic inspectors in all towns, cities, and on the road. Thank you. I really appreciate it, Professor.
Thank you, Akbar Liedem. Ubaba Ujobe Mundis.
Yes, thank you very much for the presentation from Professor. But I have just only two questions that if you can actually clarify on those questions about the youth. I'm worried about when you say the youth are more risky of car crashes. I'm trying to check what caused that. Is that because of they don't have an experience, or they buy the licenses, or they are driving, they are drinking too much? What caused the youth to be so much problematic for the crash of their cars? And then I'm trying to check if they do research, what kind of cars that they are using that cause more of these crashes? And the last one, 10% is this one. I'm worried when he says, when the professor says the reporting on roadside testing is 0%. It means there is no consequences from the relevant department or officials. So I'm trying to check why these things are not being enforced, and there is no implementation on this. Thank you very much, Chair.
Asibonge Mondise, asimthole ke ubaba Lawrence McDonald. Wehlise ke isandla Mondise, sengokuphila ngithi mfundo.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Much appreciated. I also like to thank the professor for his presentation. I just want to maybe one or two questions and some comments. On the testing that they did regarding the alcohol, was any testing done currently in South Africa, or is there any plan on doing any testing in South Africa on other drugs? Because, you know, we are heavily clamping down now on people driving with alcohol, but currently there's no legislation, or I can't find it, and not mentioned anywhere on the abuse of other drugs, like cocaine, dacha, heroin, amphetamines, that are most probably more intoxicating than alcohol and are also causing deaths on the roads. Then, this is the second time that somebody has used Saudi Arabia and other Arab countries as 0% alcohol countries. I think when you do research, you exclude those because those countries don't have alcohol at all. You can't even purchase alcohol. It's impossible to, because they don't allow alcohol in those countries because of the Sharia law. And I think those are skewed results, and in my humble opinion. And then, Chairperson, this is a specific question. We have so many alcohol-related pedestrian deaths, but we want to only punish drivers. How are we going to stop people from walking in the streets drunk at night and causing accidents and killing people? Because that's just as important as reducing the alcohol limit in drivers. I thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Honorable McDonald. Let's get, as you lower your hand, please, sir.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Thank you, Professor. Two simple questions. The first one, I'm not aware of how your institution would make submissions of this nature. So my question is in that context. Is this a Medical Research Council mandated submission? Or is it a submission of somebody working within the Medical Research Council? And again, I don't understand how such approvals, if any, are made. Secondly, it is not clear to me what your concrete recommendation is, if you could clarify that. If I hear you well, you are saying from 0% in alcohol content up to 0.02, for example, you are recommending an administrative process. So therefore, should be a fine or something like that. And anything above that, it can take any other form. If you could clarify me there, would appreciate it. Thank you, bro.
Tambas. Nago gemfuetu. As bonge ge mshekazi lapho eKapa. Ubaba uChris ubunsinga. Nazonke intambo ba.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you, Professor Perry, for your input. In particular, I like the distinction that you made on the one slide between drivers, pedestrians, and passengers. Professor, during phases of lockdown, we have had the opportunity then to be exposed in a scientific way in measurement of statistics, the filling of trauma units that was influenced by excess of alcohol and curfew. What lessons in terms of general behavior can we learn from the fact that there was limited movement and also limited availability of alcohol at various stages? What lessons can we learn from that we could apply in consideration of what we are currently debating? Thank you, Chairperson, and thanks again, Professor Perry.
Professor Perry, are you still with us? Thank you very much, Honorable Member, as I'm inviting Professor Perry back to the stage to try and deal with the clarity-seeking questions.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. So let me go through these excellent questions. First of all, Honorable Mabena, his question was, he felt that I was showing that by the research that it didn't have an effect between 0.02 and 0.05. I believe the data from Japan, Sweden, and Brazil showed an effect at certain points between 6% and I think it was 38% impact when they made that change in Japan. So certainly, we already have a 0.05 limit. We have a whole lot of other measures. So by dropping it below 0.05, I think we're not going to find it suddenly reduces road traffic injuries and deaths by 50%, because a lot of those are caused by people with higher levels of alcohol relatedness. So, but a 6, 10, 15% impact, I don't think is unreasonable, and we shouldn't say that doesn't have an effect. He asked me about other SADC countries. In fact, that paper which we published on the review of alcohol measures around the world, in fact, very few of the studies came from low and middle income countries. So there's huge gaps. So that's part of the reason why at the end of my presentation I said we need to do better in South Africa. So we need to collect the data that will help contribute to the evidence base that the WHO needs, so they don't have to rely on Japan, Sweden, and so on. There could be more data from the Brazils and South Africa. So there isn't good data, unfortunately, from Botswana or Kenya. We have to rely, if there had been, I would have included it. Moving to the Honorable Pitt Mayor, I couldn't agree with him more. I mean, better law enforcement, more inspectors, that is a crucial part of it. We will be deluding ourselves if we believe that only by dropping the BAC level, we're going to have a big impact. It's got to go hand in hand with better enforcement. Then I think we'll probably see even bigger impacts than the data that I presented from Brazil and so on. Honorable Sotoli's questions of clarification. He was spot on. What is it about youth? I think it's mostly about experience. When you become more experienced driver, you become experienced, you're learning to drive when you're 18, 19, 20, say, and many people are learning perhaps to drink then, or some people are. Many people don't drink in South Africa. But Yeah, so you put those two together. It's mostly about the experience of driving. When you add the alcohol, younger people have an even greater impact. There may be some physiological differences. Younger people may be lighter, their body less body mass than older people on average, but it's mostly about experience. I have nothing to say about the kinds of cars. They're probably better qualified people who are testifying before this portfolio committee. It was a question about why is it not enforced, but I can't, Honorable Sertoli, I can't remember the question here. Yes, okay, there was a question, I think it was to do with my example about what happened outside my house in February. Why were the police reluctant to test the blood alcohol level of the driver who may have been, it was in my impression that he was intoxicated by something. That he said that there was a court case pending against the police who had arrested someone, and the person was put in jail overnight, and the person claimed that they were incorrectly arrested because they were in fact the driver. So they were trying to confuse the police by switching drivers, and then they had the cheat to lay a complaint against the police, a court case for wrongful arrest. So that was the situation. I really don't think the police should be influenced by such tactics, and they need to go ahead and at least test the person who we all think is the driver, who says they're the driver. The Honourable MacDonald asked about other drugs. That's certainly a very important issue. Certainly, they do the road traffic, or not the different legislation. I can't remember what it is. I think it's the policing legislation does say you're not allowed to drive under the influence of alcohol or drugs. And the Crime Information Management Center puts out statistics for people driving under the influence of alcohol or drugs. So I think we have the legislation. The police can do it, but we don't tend to do it that often. And certainly with cannabis becoming more widely available, it's certainly something I think we need to look at. Point taken about Saudi Arabia, that was just my seeing it on the screen today and making a comment. So I agree with him there. We certainly need to deal with alcohol-related pedestrian injuries and deaths. And they are causing accidents or causing collisions where other people are injured or killed. And it's too easy to go after the driver, but I don't think we should not go after the drivers, but we need to then also look at measures for pedestrians. I'm not an expert on this, but certainly there have been discussions over the last 20, 25 years about getting people who are walking along roads to wear better protective clothing. We need to look at better road engineering, so there's a gap between where people are walking and where cars are. If you go to Tanzania, I was there a couple of years ago, when you're driving through the rural areas, when you get to a town, there's a physical barrier. It's like a concrete block, a small one that separates where the road is and where the pedestrians are and where the drivers are. Not very expensive, and I think we should be looking at engineering solutions. Certainly influencing driver behavior will certainly also protect pedestrians. And we need discussions. What do we do about pedestrians who drive drunk? I mean, that's something I don't have too much to say about, but perhaps we should be looking at penalties for pedestrians who walking in public spaces drunk. We should perhaps do that. Honorable Mangal, he asked about on whose behalf am I submitting. The MRC doesn't have a formal process. I mean, every time Professor Glenda Gray speaks, for example, she doesn't run it before the MRC board, speaking on behalf of the MRC. And, you know, I'm appointed as a unit director. We have external reviews of the units every 5 years. There's a rigorous process generally for appointing unit directors. We get reviewed every year. And I believe that I can speak on behalf of the MRC, but certainly I can speak on my own behalf as someone who's been doing research in this area for 20 years, as 280 publications, a B1 NRF rating. I can certainly speak on behalf of my unit, but I believe I do speak on behalf of the Medical Research Council as well. In terms of my concrete recommendations, I believe my view is that we can have a zero limit, a zero tolerance, but only prosecute people above 0.02. At 0.02 to 0.049, we should have administrative sanctions, like you do when you have a speeding in an urban area. If you go sort of 9 kilometers over the speed limit, then you generally, they don't send you the fine. 10 or more, you pay a fine between 10 and 29 kilometers over the speed limit. 30 kilometers over the speed limit, you have a mandatory court appearance. Certainly, I know in the Western Cape that's supposed to happen according to legislation. So we're talking of 0.02 to 0.05, an administrative sanction. Above 0.05, continue with the criminal sanctions. Honorable Hunsinger raised the thorny issue of the COVID-19 and issues around trauma and mobility. I can certainly speak at length about that, but I don't think I've got very much time, about a minute. But certainly our view at the MRC, and I'm talking of at least two units here, is that it's a combination of the restrictions of mobility and of the alcohol sales ban, which had that dramatic impact on trauma dropping and trauma coming back when those restrictions were lifted. And certainly also when we look at non-natural deaths, we've published a paper on that, which showed that for example, the changing of the curfew by 1 hour had a very modest effect on increasing non-natural deaths. So it's both. Certainly there's some data coming out of the United States, which actually showed that they're seeing an increase in road trauma during the lockdown, which despite some of the restrictions on movement. So it's complicated. The industry is trying to muddy the water, I believe, by saying it's all due to the restrictions on mobility. Certainly one example, if you look at that, we had no trauma at Chris Harney Baragwanath over New Year's Eve. Does that mean there was nobody walking around at all in Soweto, for example? No, it was because of both restrictions on mobility, curfews, but also very much the restrictions on the alcohol sales. Thank you, Honorable Chair.
Professor, thank you very much for the insightful presentation and responses. We can assure you that as we sit as the portfolio committee taking this process forward, we will also take your inputs into serious consideration as we are looking to get a solution to the challenge that we are faced as a country. We want to thank you very much for having made time to come and speak to us on this very important matter. We do not wish to hold you more than what you have bargained for. If you don't have anything to say, I wish to take this opportunity to thank you and liberate you from this meeting.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, Professor. You are now liberated. Honorable members, according to the program I have in front of me here, Professor was the last speaker for the day. Am I correct, Valerie?
Yes, Chairperson.
So I wish to thank all the members of this committee for having participated vigorously on this process. Mushito Tswela Pele, Husani, we will see each other tomorrow on the same platform, same time, for different presenters. Let me allow you to go and prepare for the subcommittee, which has an important agenda to deal with. Thank you to the department. I have seen Talia has posted that departmental officials were here. Am I correct, Tandi?
You're correct. Afternoon, Chair. You're correct. Yeah.
Okay.
Hi.
Okay. Thank you very much, Tandi. Where are they? Abu Babu Shabisa, are you here, Mr. Shabisa?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, Chairperson, I'm here. Thank you very much. Thank you.
DDG Makhatu?
Chairperson, good afternoon. Indeed, I'm in attendance, and afternoon to the honorable members and colleagues. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. I think I just wanted to greet you and acknowledge that I did get a message that you tuned in a bit later. There are two hands that would want to remind me something. Baba Ulisa Gamangu no Baba Utamsa.
Tomorrow should be 6, not 9 a.m. 6 p.m. Thank you, Chair.
Wow. Wow. Yeah, no. I always test whether members are still with us, and I can see two members were lively and present up until to the last. Baba Uchambas no Baba Umapena. I know you're going to raise the same issue. As a teacher, I used to do that to my students, just to test whether they are listening. We will meet tomorrow evening as the honorable member Ubaba Ulisa Komani have said. All the best to the subcommittee for their meeting straight after this. Otherwise, we meet tomorrow in the evening. Thank you very much. You are released. Thank you.
Not liberated.
Long live everybody.
Long